on General Government. It's April the 28th, 2005, 3:10. It's the time we're supposed to start. We're a little late. At this time, I'm going to open up as a subcommittee for the purpose of a public hearing on House Bill 2395A. Judith, tell us about that.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. House Bill 2395A allows local governments to invest funds held in trust for employees under deferred compensation programs in shares of stock, including mutual funds. We have received a no revenue and no fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Greg, Brent, come on up. Let's hear about this thing.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm the, for the record, Greg McPherson, State Representative for House District 38, and I am the sponsor of this bill. It's just a technical fix. It relates to deferred compensation plan dollars for local government employees in Oregon. These are amounts that an employee elects to reduce their pay by and then have invested, and they build up on a tax-sheltered basis and then are distributed at retirement to supplement their PERS or other retirement benefits that are provided by the employer, but they are employee-provided. This type of plan is provided by the state for state employees and some local governments, but other local governments also have the authority to create these plans on their own, and it is that distinction that drives the need for this bill. The federal law was changed some years ago so that the amounts that were held under these elective deferred compensation plans could be invested in corporate stock, including mutual funds, which is the way one achieves the best return on assets over time. That is, even though there's volatility in the stock market, and it goes up and down, it does go up a little faster over the long pole than other forms of investment. In order to accomplish that form of investment for local government deferred compensation plans in the past, it has been necessary to go through an intermediary kind of device, like an insurance policy that invests itself in mutual funds because of a statute prohibited a direct investment.
Mm-hmm.
And unfortunately, in life generally, whenever there's a middleman, they take a slice. The purpose of this bill is to take out that middleman, to allow the direct investment in stock so that we get a higher return provided to our employees who are saving for retirement through this kind of device. It just conforms the law for local government deferred compensation plans to be consistent with what is already true for the state's deferred compensation plans. So it's just a simple bill passed unanimously so far on the House side in committee and on the floor, and expect it should win that kind of favor on this side of the building. Would be available for any questions you might have.
I'm fine. Let's go ahead.
Okay, very good. Brent, do you want to say anything here while you're here?
My name is Brent Petty. I'm with a firm up in Portland, Oregon, by the name of Arnerich Messina.
Mm-hmm.
We represent, we're an independent party that represent local municipalities and negotiate with vendors that provide these deferred compensation. And I would just like to go on record saying that we do business on the West Coast primarily, and that we are seeing much more competitive pricing and plans being put together in other regions when we are fortunate enough to eliminate this middleman and go direct. And so, in summary, to Representative McPherson, this is a benefit to participants by, in essence, reducing fees.
Mm-hmm.
And I'll conclude with that. Thank you for your time.
Well, I'm not too sure I want you to conclude. You may need to stall here just a little bit. I'm trying to get a committee. If not, we can close the public hearing on it. Let me just ask this question. The two of you will stay right there. Is there anyone else who would like to testify on House Bill 2395? Okay. Let's stand at ease for a couple of minutes here and just see if we can. Cause we just will get this work done.
Yeah.
If you two, I know you needed to leave, Representative.
Right here until we get somebody else in, and we can put this thing.
Just in case they have any question, it seems very straightforward to me. All right. With that, I'll stand at ease. Thanks. And at this time, I'm going to open up, still as a subcommittee, a public hearing on House Joint Memorial 1010.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Joint Memorial 10 urges Congress to enact and the President to sign the Tsunami Preparedness Act, and that Congress continue efforts to further expand and modernize tsunami direction and warning systems for the Pacific Ocean area. We have received a no fiscal and, of course, no revenue on House Joint Memorial 10. Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Okay, we have written testimony only. Do we have any idea?
Too bad that we don't have a third member. We can move this out.
I know. We have two of them we can do right now. Gee, you know, I should have thought about that, and I'm sorry about that. Any chance we're going to get?
Member should be here, yes.
Okay.
Member should be on the way down.
Okay.
And we'll see where...
Senator Shields isn't being continuing to be here today?
He'll
be here at 4. Would you like to come up and just talk about this? We already know everything about this. If not, you think? All right, let's have a few. We fall into this trap when the chair is not feeling well.
Thank you. For the record, my name is Vicki McConnell, and I'm the director for the Oregon Department of Geology and Mineral Industries. I have submitted some written testimony in support of this House Joint Memorial. And as you, Vice Chair, as you were mentioning, Senator Verger probably would enjoy being here because I know she's a sponsor of this, or one of the co-sponsors of this joint memorial. In general, it simply urges the state legislature to support a Senate Congressional Tsunami Preparedness Act that is going through the Congressional Senate right now. It would be very important. It would strengthen some of the research, the monitoring, and the educational aspects of the work that we do here in the state for tsunami preparedness. And so we would be, we're certainly in support of that that Congressional Act.
I'm going to continue to stall. We had Peter Jennings right after the great tsunami here a few months ago made a statement that we were some of the best prepared. Then there was information out there that actually Oregon wasn't prepared. My feeling is when we began this process back right around 1999, I believe I've seen a lot of progress myself. I mean, you know, when we did the tour down to OSU and we were able to look at the engineering, just to kind of put that in perspective for everyone, how do you believe we're prepared in relationship to, say, like California or Washington State?
Senator George, Vice Chair, all of the five Pacific states that make up what we call the Pacific Rim, and the five states, Hawaii, Alaska, Washington, Oregon, and California, have, if you compare them to the rest of the international community, we are very well prepared because, as you said, we have been working with NOAA for several years now to have a tsunami prepared program. However, what we found, and one thing that was very clearly shown in the Sumatra disaster, was that without continuing education to keep folks aware of what that particular disaster and what the hazards and what the warning signs are, that it tends to slip out of people's minds. These are the type of hazards that occur infrequently but are quite catastrophic when they do occur. So that certainly these congressional acts that are in place now would strengthen that type of continuing education and really one-on-one help to the local communities. So we see that is a very important aspect of that act and of our job here in the state as well.
One of the issues that came up with some of the other hearings on this issue was that a lot of folks were afraid that, you know, somebody down on the coast, and I'm headed there real soon, is that as soon as I get to anywhere on the coast, I immediately analyze where I am. I look at the roads that are going to go up the hill, and I actually make preparation in my mind of what we will do if we should get the alarm or the warning. It doesn't make me sleepy, uneasy at night. It doesn't make me nervous. None of those sort of things. I think that's kind of the general reaction if people know a plan, you know, and feel comfortable to execute the plan. You know, people don't get off of an airplane when we do the thing about if the airplane crashed in the water, grab your seat cushion. So do you find that's the case? I mean, have you heard anything that people are literally discouraged from going and enjoying, you know, the coastal areas because of fear? if they have preparation.
Mr. Chair and committee members, I think that your point is well made. We generally don't find that people don't get on airplanes. Well, you know, you have a few. There's always a few folks. But you generally, if you understand what the hazard is and how you can prepare or mitigate for that, that's a very, very important aspect. And I commend you for thinking about where the high ground is whenever you head to the coast. That's exactly what you should do. The other thing you should do is look and see if there are evacuation maps available that would show you the exact routes, the safest and the easiest routes to get to that high ground. Mm-hmm. So we have, I do not have statistics to back it up, but I have never heard of any major complaints from folks on the coast that are involved or active in preparing or making folks aware of a tsunami hazard, that it's affected the overall tourist industry out there.
Terrific. We have a quorum. Are you ready to move this thing?
Yeah, I don't have a problem with that.
Okay. Are you familiar with any questions about that? That's all that is that urges Congress to enact the Tsunami Preparedness Act.
Yep.
Okay.
I read the bill, Mr. Chair. I'm ready to go.
All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
I'm going to close the public hearing on House Joint Memorial 10 with the tap of the gavel. We'll also open a work session on that same bill.
Oh, hello there.
Looking to you.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, I would move SJM 10 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation, or HJM 10, I'm sorry, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved HJM 10 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion or questions about that or the bill? If not, is there any objection to that motion? Seeing none, so moved. I know a senator from the coast that would probably love to carry him.
Since I live in the tsunami zone.
All right, we're doing that. All right, now, we had opened just a few minutes ago House Bill 395 and subcommittee, and we took testimony. There was no opposition. Do you guys want a little time to take a look at that? Judith, why don't you go back? Can you grab it real quick and run back through it, and I will see what I did with that file.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2395A is the measure that allows local governments to invest funds held in trust for employees under deferred compensation programs in shares of stock, including mutual funds. We have a no revenue and no fiscal on the measure.
Okay. Did I close 10? Okay, I need to close the work session, House Joint Memorial 10, and I'm going to open up a work session on House Bill 32395 as amended. And Judith, you just gave us preparation. Okay.
So, and Mr. Chair, you heard testimony already, and
yes,
I have a letter in my file from the city manager of Eugene supporting this bill, and I reviewed it, so I'm prepared to make a motion.
Very good. Thank you.
Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2395 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2395 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any further discussion? Okay. Committee, then, we will do it without objection. Thank you very much. I'll close the work session on House Bill 2395A. And with that, I think we'll go back to the front of the schedule and start working forward.
Mr. Chair, did you need someone to carry that bill?
And I was going to ask you if you wanted to do that. If not, I will.
Okay. That's fine.
Okay, are you all right? Okay, very good. Are you prepared to go ahead? Now, what I'd like to do, let me ask Judith on this, I'll go back to a work session with, and we'll move all of them as one motion. Is that okay?
Yeah, here's actually the correct script for her. That's for you.
Okay.
Okay.
And let me wait. Let me open up a work session.
Okay.
I'm going to, because that is a work session action, right? Open up a work session. What we're going to do at this point is we're going to move Senate Bill 420, Senate Bill 500, Senate Bill 578, and House Bill 2005. They will be referred to the Committee on Senate Rules.
I see. We can do that. Mr. Chair, I make a motion to move Senate Bill 420, Senate Bill 500, Senate Bill 578, and House Bill 2005 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Very good. Thank you, Senator. Senator Walker has moved Senate Bill 420, Senate Bill 500, Senate Bill 578, and House Bill 2005 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill will be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any further discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I amend that motion to add Senate Bill 310, Senate Bill 984, and Senate Bill 1003?
We could have probably, but I think the chair would show up very quickly.
Oh, I appreciate that. Dose of humor, though, Senator Starr. It was really needed.
All right. To the actual motion, is there any objection? Okay. So moved. Now, with that, I'll close the work session on for the purpose of referring to Senate rules, and we will open a public hearing on Senate Bill 1031.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate Bill 1031 establishes requirements for phone directory. You have the Dash 1 amendments at your materials at the dais. The Dash 1 amendments essentially replace the bill except for the section that places the language in a particular chapter. And otherwise, the Dash 1 amendments would replace everything else, and it would direct the Public Utility Commission to establish by rule standards for listing federal, state, and local government offices, as well as schools and other human services to be included in telephone directories. We have received a no fiscal and no revenue impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you, Judith. At this time, I would like to ask some of that have signed up to come forward to testify on this bill. We have Jim Long, Shelley Jensen, and David Paulson. Does everyone have a copy of the amendments? Okay, so we'll... Oh, additional, okay.
Did I have a packet here?
This must be...
You're the first to be seated. We'll let you go ahead and begin.
Good afternoon, Vice Chair Senator George and committee members. My name is Jim Long. I live in rural Washington County. Thank you for having this hearing today relating to telephone directories. Oregonians are outnumbered by telephone directories, which is the traditional database they've been using for years. The 10-page 2004 Oregon Department of Justice Blue Pages memo by Mike Weirich discusses the PUC authority over telephone directories and clearly says the PUC does have authority over telephone directories. This bill is before you because, as petitioner, upon the encouragement that has come from both Assistant Attorney General Mike Weirich and PUC Telecommunications Manager Phil Nygaard to seek legislation to clarify the Commission's authority regarding telephone directories. Currently, there is no rule regarding telephone directory blue pages, and there are many inconsistencies, inadequacies, errors, and omissions that exist in the 75 Oregon telephone directories I've been able to review. Part of the problem is that the new telecommunications utilities and publishers have made cutbacks. Consumers are frustrated when they can't find what they're looking for in phone books. If a person doesn't know the name of an agency, he or she will have a difficult time finding it alphabetically. And if the agency doesn't receive a classified listing, it will be even more difficult to find. On February 2nd, the Portland City Council unanimously supported the resolution to participate in the Blue Pages rulemaking. Did you know that in the white pages of the Portland phone book, 33% to 45% of the City of Portland listings are inaccurate? And the Blue Pages have been omitted from the Yellow Pages volume, this volume, the biggest in the state, for the third year. The Blue Pages are good for public safety, public health, public relations, public education, government.
Did we get Shelby Eddie's name?
Oh, no,
he's okay, all right. Excuse me, go ahead.
The Public Utility Commission supported similar legislation in 2003, but now that there's a rulemaking proceeding open, they cannot take a position on this. This is what they've been told by their attorneys. The idea for a bill was originally right out here in the tall when I met Jim Spinden, the head of the Oregon State Sheriff's Association. I mentioned that Verizon had left out the 20-page human service guide in the Washington County Directory. He said, go upstairs, let's get a bill. Senator Max Williams sponsored a bill the last two sessions. We've been going through the proceeding. A new development is that Oregon 211, which is a consolidation of information referral agencies around the state, is operating in a few parts of the state, and they have their goal is to operate statewide. They support the Blue Pages rulemaking procedure because there are inconsistencies. The format could be improved. The Oregon 211 offers a great opportunity. They have a centralized database, and they can easily do the updating of the human service guide. One thing I wanted to do, and it's in the material I got out to you, is the format. One of the things we were doing is a format. This format was approved and recommended by the telephone industry back in 24 years ago in 1981. It has an emergency services box up here for elder abuse, child abuse, poison control, rape crisis, resource services. This book is printed and used. This format is used in three books at this time in the state. They're Verizon books. I like the format. Washington County, Gresham, the Southern Oregon Coast. They don't really have the box done as well as they used to, but it's a good format. It's for life and death. So the people, if they're looking for something, they'll be able to find something very easily. So our hope is to improve the phone books, establish the Blue Pages, and update them. In the Portland phone book, in the Blue Pages, there's a portion in there that's underutilized, and we would like to be able to put URLs, so that we can have a 24-hour city hall, 24-hour courthouse, 24-hour state house, so people who have computer access can access the information readily. But for those people who don't have computers, we need upgraded Blue Pages. It's still the front door for Oregonians to receive services, be it at the city, county, or federal level. The state mandates a number of services, and there's over $1 billion worth of services provided by state and local government. We need to help people find those services. If you have any questions, I'd be glad to answer them.
James, have you seen the Dash ones? Are those all right with you?
Yes, I helped put them together. Yeah. The reason for them is that the PUC has an open rulemaking docket now,
right,
and they will set the details of a rule. So what you have in front of you, I would say, you know, should say public schools. And if there's a question on terminology, I know the phone company has been hemming and hawing about what is a human service. Maybe we need the word community in there, so we're talking about nonprofit, real community services instead of private professionals. Okay. But otherwise, it's very clear.
But you're okay with the idea that, you know, that we need to move this thing along, and that's something you could work on?
Right. I like the intent of the bill, and it really does have no fiscal. I'll be glad to work with it. It has no fiscal. The word that I don't like in there when it says must include, it should be may include for all the different, the emergency preparedness information and things of that order.
Okay.
So, but otherwise, it's fine. I'll be glad to work more with committees throughout the process.
Great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Chair George, members of the committee, for the record, my name is David Paulson. I'm Government Affairs Manager for Sprint. We're located in Hood River. We serve around 70,000 access lines in the state, all in rural Oregon. Although we don't own our own directory company, we do contract with R.H. Donnelly, and they put our directory together for us. For as long as I can remember, and I'm not sure what the beginning point of this was, we've had in our directories both blue and pink pages. The blue pages, I believe, include government listings. The pink pages include city, county, state, and also human services agency listings. We're not aware of from our customer base that they've had concerns, complaints, that there have been significant errors, as Mr. Long has mentioned earlier in the directory. We haven't heard from our customers or the government agencies or human services agencies if that's the case. We just haven't been aware of it, so we feel that our listings are pretty accurate. Are they perfect? I'm not going to sit here and say they are, but if there's an error, we're certainly made aware of it and correct it in the next directory.
Probably we here in this building changed the phone numbers on you anyway, so you were probably started off correct.
There you go. Mr. Law mentioned 211. We think that 211 is probably a really good solution to this problem if there is a problem that exists. 211 has already been deployed in much of the Portland metro area. It should be statewide within the next 3 to 4 years. Frankly, that's a great vehicle for people who need help to go to, because if they don't know the listings, as Mr. Long mentioned, they can ask the 211 operator, and he or she can then tell them where they're best served and can connect them, put them in touch with them. In fact, 211 did a survey of customers that called in. I think when they did that, the vast majority of customers who called 211 said they did not even attempt to use the phone book, but they went right to 211. Many of them said, we're not sure who can help us. Therefore, the phone book wouldn't have been a help in that. So we think 211 is equipped to do what needs to be done here. And we think in light of that, that the solutions being proposed here are bureaucratic and costly. If we have to add pages to our phone directory, it's going to cost in excess of $10,000 per page. That cost gets passed on to our customers and to the government. And therefore, we think that this is not needed. And it's an expense and a bureaucracy at the PUC that's not really required. We're not even sure how the PUC would enforce this, considering the fact that directories are published by all kinds of people in the state, not just with my telcos. So we urge that you not support Senate Bill 1031. Thank you. I'm glad to answer any questions.
Any questions for Mr. Paulson? Thank you very much.
Chair George, committee members, I'm Shelley Jensen, Regulatory and Governmental Affairs Manager for Verizon. And I won't repeat what Mr. Paulson said because we agree with all the points that he made, but I did want to point out that Mr. Long referred to an Attorney General's opinion about regulating directories. And one of our objections to this whole idea is the PUC can only regulate directories that are connected to telephone utilities. They cannot regulate directories that are put out by folks who just do directories or internet or any of those kinds of things. And so, in addition to everything that Mr. Paulson mentioned, we also don't think it's appropriate to just regulate one segment of the industry. And that's all the PUC has the authority to do. So, again, we would also ask that you not pass this bill. Thank you.
Question for any of the three of you. The telephone directories provided, you know, telephone customers. Are there, because I've heard there are telephone books provided to the customers that do not, in fact, have any of those, the blue page directory type. Do we know how many that is that are out there? Because I think, James, isn't that what you're attempting to address?
Well, we work with what we have. The regulated or the telecommunications utilities have a duty to provide phone books, and they have a duty to provide adequate service. So they have a duty to provide good quality phone books that people are going to be able to use. I'm not sure how many phone books out there don't have blue pages. I do know there's a number of them. I haven't been able to find them. Mostly all I can find are the ones put together by the primary telecommunications utilities.
Okay.
Could I also pipe up here?
Yes.
Chair George, committee members, I think most, if not all, of the regulated telephone companies do provide blue pages in their phone books. I think the books that you're talking about are probably ones that are provided by independent publishers, and this rule wouldn't get at them because
right.
the PUC doesn't have the ability to require them to do anything.
But is this this language where it says that telephone directories provided to telephone customers would obviously by, you know, whoever your source is, your provider, that would apply to them and not anyone else anyway?
It would apply to us, for want of a better word, the traditional telephone companies.
Right.
But not, for example, I know we have an office in Salem, and I have two directories there that have been dropped off not by Quest, but by other folks who just publish telephone directories. It would not apply to them.
Right.
So, and that's part of our issue, that if you're going to impose requirements, you should impose it on everybody who's in the business, not just one segment of the business.
And that may be where I go, because I remember looking at this phone book thing, where are the blue pages? And now that I think about it, that probably was one of those additional ones that get dropped out your driveway type of thing.
Mm-hmm.
Any further questions for guests?
Chair George?
Yes.
Members of the committee,
pull the mic back over a little closer if you would.
Thank you. Chair George, members of the committee, one correction and clarification on my written testimony. From a copy I passed out earlier to you in the last bullet point, so this would address accurately Mr. Long's amendment to this, I have taken out the reference to Section 3. It no longer applies because of the amendment.
Because of the amendment.
So I removed that last sentence in the last bullet point.
Okay.
It's not really relevant at this point.
Yes.
I would have the pleasure of rebutting some information later, if you have time.
Oh, okay. Well, I'll tell you what, if you'd like to stay there, Jenny, would you like to come on up? Thank you, too, for testifying.
Thank you.
Well, Mr. Chair, I guess I wasn't
Were the folks that were testifying, Ms. Jensen and Mr. Paulson, testifying in opposition to the Dash 1 amendments as well as the original bill?
Dash 1 and Dash 3, okay. Basically the whole bill.
Okay.
I thought I understood. Yeah.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Lang, and I represent Quest. I don't have a great deal to add in terms of substance, but I did want to just characterize Quest's relationship with its publisher. Dex is a separate publishing company. It is no longer part of the telephone company. So as Mr. Paulson mentioned, we contract with Dex to publish our directory, and we have made every effort to include the kind of listings that Mr. Long suggests that should be in the blue pages. I will hasten to add that this doesn't mean that we get them right every time, but we make every effort to do that, and we certainly have a commitment to providing the kinds of information that that is suitable for the communities. I would also echo the testimony that with the advent of internet access as well as the expansion of the 211 program, that seems to make better sense for a wider range of users of telephone books than continuing to work at issues like this. So as with the other two telephone company witnesses, I would urge you to not support this bill or the Dash 1 amendments. Thank you.
And the Dash 3 also?
Dash 1 is what I...
I only have a Dash 1.
Oh, Dash 1?
Dash 1?
Well, it's me that's referring to a Dash 3 that doesn't exist. Well, it's good that you guys are all united in case I decide to write Dash 3. All right. Thank you very much. James, would you like to speak to this? Because what I'm going to have to do here, Mr. Chairman, if you'd like to step into this seat, okay. Find out where what this committee is thinking about this bill. You ready to do that?
Not yet.
Not yet. Go ahead, James.
Go ahead.
Well, you can have other people testify. I'll come back if something really needs to. Okay, things I hadn't said. The Metropolitan Service District, there were over a dozen errors, omissions, deletions in the phone book that they incurred also in this year. Now, Quest Dex Media did print up, I don't know how many, 100,000, I don't know how many thousands, 100,000 inserts for the phone book to correct the corrections that they did. I'm not sure why they left all the in errors and deletions and omissions that Metro had cited at the same time. So it's a concern about the inattentiveness on some of the details and getting some of the information and the listings for public and nonprofit agencies correct.
Okay. We have no one else signed up to testify on Senate Bill 1031. Is there anyone else who would like to speak to this bill? Thanks, James, very much. At this time, I'm going to close the public hearing on Senate Bill 1031, and I'll hand the gavel to the chair.
So what I'd like to do is open a public hearing on House Bill 2133.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2133 extends to members of organized militias of other states reemployment rights when called into active service. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. This is to clarify that those participating in Oregon militias already have reemployment rights. This would extend those reemployment rights to members of other states' militias, and that refers to a requirement that employers grant leaves of absence for the duration of the active state militia service and reemploy employees upon termination of that service without loss of accumulated benefits. We have received a no revenue and a minimal fiscal on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question that I shouldn't ask is this didn't receive, I don't think, any opposition in the House, did it? Was it totally supported?
That's correct. 57 ayes, 2 excused from the floor.
I don't have anybody signed up to speak on this House bill. Are there any advocates that want to do so? Senator George, it sounds like you're wanting to say something about it.
No. The only question I had when Judith was reading this thing was the question about we're not certainly going to attempt to bind another state to that obligation. This would be for those that would be employed
serving
here.
Serving in Oregon, yes.
I'm going to get that on the record. Okay. And particularly since I'm looking for dash three.
You're just dashing from place to place, aren't you? Well, if there's no testimony, I'm going to move from a hearing to a work session on House Bill 2133.
Mr. Chairman,
yeah.
I would like to move House Bill 2133 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Is there any opposition to the motion? Hearing none, seeing none, so ordered, it's moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Just to prove that I'm still alive, I'll carry it. How's that? Okay. House Bill 2135. Let's open a hearing on that one.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2135 extends to National Guard members called into active federal military service benefits currently limited to National Guard members called into active service of the state by the governor. It clarifies that active military duty for up to 30 consecutive months does not constitute a change of circumstances with respect to the terms and conditions of a joint custody order. It would declare an emergency effective on passage. We have received a no revenue and a no fiscal on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
No one has signed up on this one either.
Oh, this is your phone.
Is there?
I wondered where that went. I was looking for.
Any comments from the committee on this bill under hearing? If not, I'm going to close the hearing on the bill and ask a question in the work session. What's the present circumstance with regard to this issue? I mean, does this represent? It sounded like the months consideration had changed. Is that the idea? Does this represent a change considering kind of the new role of the National Guard, which, you know, has gone from mainly kind of defense of the homeland to being in a foreign war, therefore being out there in the line of fire, quote-unquote, longer and away from work longer and stuff? What's the scoop?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. You are right. This is extending the benefit to those called to federal military service,
right.
Extending the same benefits that those National Guardsmen get when they're serving within the state of Oregon. So it does extend that, recognizing their new role across the state.
So presently, the time frame just doesn't fit the new reality. Okay?
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? Is there any? Well, I guess we need a motion.
Yep, you're in a work session. I'll move.
Okay.
Mr. Chairman, thank you very much. House Bill 2135. I move that we send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves 2135 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered. Do you want to carry this?
I can carry.
Okay. Senator Verger will carry House Bill 2135. The next one is 2161, is that right?
Correct.
Okay.
So you want to open a public hearing?
I'll open a public hearing on 2161.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2161 abolishes the Oregon Capital Corporation. We have a no revenue and no fiscal on this measure.
And we have Floyd Lanter from DCBS, Division of Finance, Corporate Securities, to talk about this for a few minutes.
Thank you, Chair Shields. Members of the committee, good afternoon. For the record, my name is Floyd Lanter. I'm the administrator of the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities within DCBS. I'm here today to request your support for House Bill 2161. Written testimony is provided, and I'll briefly outline the merits of the proposed legislation orally. This is a statutory cleanup bill that repeals the authority concerning what is known as the Oregon Capital Corporation. The enabling legislation dates to 1987 and required the predecessor to the department to certify a single entity before July 1st, 1989, capitalized at a minimum of $40 million, to provide for risk capital investments. tax credits of 20% per dollar invested were provided to attract investors. Despite the merits of the proposal, the July 1989 date has long since passed, and no Oregon Capital Corporation was ever certified, nor were there ever any applicants seeking certification. The law no longer serves its intended purpose, and the responsibilities for the department never materialized. The bill is fee neutral. We're not aware of any opposition. The bill passed the House with 53 ayes and one nay. I would respectfully request the committee support the bill and send it to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Are there any questions relative to this testimony?
Just amazed it didn't get used.
Huh?
He's just amazed it didn't get used. We just figure we might as well get rid of it if it's not being used. Creative accounting.
Okay. If there's no discussion, I'll close the hearing, open a work session. You want to do this? Make a motion.
Makes sense to me. I mean, it's...
That's an interesting motion. Makes sense to me.
Yeah.
You want to try to script again?
Let's see.
The chair has his sense of humor back.
No, that's good. He's feeling better.
Yeah.
He's trying to embarrass me. Now I'm red. Mr. Chairman, I would like to...
Are you saying you're from one of those red states?
I'm still trying to find Dash 3. I would like, Mr. Chairman, move House Bill 2161, correct, to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
You got the bill number right.
Okay.
Senator George moves House Bill 2161 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered, and so that Senator George can figure out what this bill is, I'll let him carry it. How's that? Okay, where are we now?
2173.
You have a check beside it for some reason.
Oh, that was... That's some other language.
Yes. Okay, so we are going to move to open a hearing on 2173, repeals the Digital Signature Act. That sounds like fun.
Yes, sir, Mr. Chair. And I will just point out you have the Dash 1 amendments for 2173, and those simply replace references to, quote, digital, unquote, signatures with the term electronic with respect to those signatures. We have a no revenue and a minimal fiscal on the measure.
You're a very bright man, Floyd. You just stayed right there.
Thank you, Chair Shields, members of the committee. Again, for the record, Floyd Lanter, Administrator for the Division of Finance and Corporate Securities. Appear today to request a committee support for House Bill 2173 with the Dash 1 amendment. Written testimony is provided, and I'll attempt to briefly provide an outline of the merits of the bill orally. This bill is designed to eliminate government regulation of two small programs administered by the department that provide for optional or voluntary registration or participation. Neither program has generated much interest or activity over the years. And the two programs involved are the Digital Signature Certification Authorities and International Trade Consultants Registry. With respect to the first, the Digital Signatures Act, enacted in 1997, provided the department the authority to certify persons who issue digital certificates, such as companies like VeriSign or NTrust, that are used to provide electronic credentials or authentication and facilitate e-commerce activity. Now, it's somewhat technical, but digital certificates provide assurance that the person sending a document is who they claim to be and that the document has not been altered since its transmission. The Act provided for optional registration with the department and created no meaningful enforcement tools. In fact, the Act provides in part, quote, nothing in this section shall be construed to compel any public or private entity to participate in the director certification program as authorized in this section in order to verify digital signatures. Over the seven-year period the law has been in effect, we've received no consumer complaints, and very few companies have opted to register with us. In 2002, we had two companies, and in 2003 and 2004, we had one. The bill will have no impact on e-commerce or the ability to provide authenticated digital signatures. technology continues to advance and the Department of Administrative Services now regards digital signatures as a subset of the electronic signatures provisions of the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. The Dash 1 amendments...
It's just so thrilling.
Pardon?
Mm-hmm. That was a captivating sentence. Would you like to repeat that for posterity? Digital signatures are a subset of who?
Of the electronic signatures provisions.
I see.
Of the Uniform Electronic Transactions Act. As a point of clarification, that's a uniform law that's been passed by 49 states to govern these transactions.
I see.
And the Dash 1 amendments reflect that view by the Department of Administrative Services. Additionally, there are federal e-authentication policy, which provides additional standards. This bill simply eliminates the option of registering with the department, an option that few, if any, choose to take. And language in the current digital signature law that requires the Department of Administrative Services to oversee the use of digital electronic signatures by state agencies is retained and transferred to Chapter 84 of the ORS. The rest of the law is eliminated, and the department feels it's good government to eliminate laws from the books that serve no purpose and only serve to confuse.
Now there's the piece of it that you like.
Do we have to repeat back what he said before, though?
Yeah, I'm going to make you carry this one and repeat that sentence. Okay.
There is a second portion.
Oh, good. I can't wait.
That is with respect to international trade consultants. The 2001 legislature enacted this section, which directed the department to establish a voluntary registry of international trade consultants. Eligible registrants are those involved with finding international markets for private businesses or assisting them with international laws or market practices. In 2002, we had two entities registered. In 2003 and 2004, we had one. Again, the program is strictly voluntary, requires a candidate to submit certain information and pay a fee of $100. There are no provisions or mechanisms for verifying the accuracy of the information provided. The registry simply serves as a locator tool for possible businesses looking for a consultant. And given the lack of participation in the registry by international trade consultants in Oregon, the registration appears to provide no meaningful service. There are a couple of small ending fund balances with respect to these programs. They collectively total $3,800, and those would be transferred to the general fund with the abolishment of the programs.
Hey, we're fundraising.
We're underway. Send us revenue.
This is fee neutral, and we're not aware of any opposition to the bill, and it was passed in the House with 58 ayes and 2 excused. And I would respectfully request your support with the Dash 1 amendments and send it to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Okay. Is there any comment?
I'd like to put dibs on that $3,843, Mr. Chair.
You see, what did you say?
I said I'd like to take dibs on that $3,843 for an education program.
Right.
That's
okay.
Down in Ways and Means.
I think. I'll let you carry it.
Yeah.
Oh, enjoy.
We have some Dash 1s or Dash 2s or Dash something or others.
Dash 1.
We're still in hearing.
Okay.
I'm going to close the hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2173.
Mr. Chairman, I move the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2173.
Senator George moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2173. Is there any objection? Seeing none, so ordered.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would like to move House Bill 2173 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 2173 to the floor as amended with a due pass recommendation. Any objection? So ordered. You can give it your best shot, Senator Walker. See if you can get that $3,000 when you carry the bill.
Okay. Chair, I'll try to make this an interesting
bill. You can
bill.
Make that an exciting
exciting. Serious words.
And we're going to open a hearing on House Bill 2214. Make the technical correction to the public contracting code. Is there anybody signed up on this one? Actually, there's several people. Gee, this is exciting. I'm going to get them all here.
Good.
Once. What?
That's good.
As soon as I can read their signatures and their writing, try that.
Dugan Petty.
Dugan Petty. Dugan, who ever taught you how to write? Jessica, I can read her signature. And Stephen Kafori. I'll just have you all come and talk to me about this bill. Quickly. Briefly. Dugan, you got your name up there first. Maybe that because you wrote faster than the other two. I don't know.
Apparently it looks like it.
Yeah, it does look like it, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, for the record, my name is Dugan Petty. I'm the Deputy Administrator with the State Services Division of the Department of Administrative Services. House Bill 2214 is a bill that makes technical corrections to the procurement code rewrite of last session. And when it came over, we had a couple of pieces of unfinished business. One of them was to work out some hour of wage provisions with the Bureau of Labor and Industry in advance. Inadvertently, they were left out of the bill, and so that needed to be adjusted. And we've had a number of meetings with them, DOJ and BOLI, AGC, and we believe that those have been resolved in the Dash 2 amendment. Also, another piece of unfinished business was the treatment of energy-saving performance contracting. And I know the Department of Justice, DAS, and Mr. Kafori have met, and we believe we have a solution to that from our perspective in the Dash 2 amendments. We should say that Dana Anderson would be here today. He was really carrying this bill as a law improvement bill. He has had some medical difficulties that have prevented him from being with us today, and we have two of his colleagues from the Department of Justice who are happy to answer any questions about it.
Okay.
We support the Dash 2 amendment and urge the committee to pass it out.
Is there any questions? Jessica? Thank you for your very clear handwriting there on
Mr. Chair, thank you very much for the compliment. I have two kids in the back of the room that we work with every day to do clear handwriting, so this is lesson that pays off. So.
And Dugan's glad he didn't have any kids sitting in a room and read his writing. Yes.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson here today on behalf of the Associated General Contractors. We're here to very simply say we support the Dash 2 amendment. This is a series of important corrections to the public contracting rewrite, the major bill that passed last session. We appreciate the committee's consideration of this bill and urge your support and quick passage of this legislation.
Okay, thank you, Jessica. Stephen?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Stephen Kafori. I'm here representing Johnson Controls. We are an energy savings performance contractor that does this kind of work here in the state of Oregon. Our concern about the bill was not at all substantive. It was purely trying to clear up something that might be misunderstood. Our amendments do that. They don't change the bill substantively in any way, and we met with all the people in the room to make sure that was the case. We just wanted to make sure that there is as great a flexibility for state and local governments when they hire energy saving performance contractors to use a procurement process that fits their needs and is guarantees a maximum of flexibility, and that is in the law. It just wasn't clear to our folks and to some procurement officers out there, so we, I think, made it clearer.
Okay.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would like to, I guess, maybe ask a question or make a statement, but, you know, I got this when I got here today. And it may not be substantive, but unless I'm mistaken, is everything in the bold black changes?
Mr. Chair, mm-hmm. Senator Berger, yes.
Yes. So I'm just flipping through page 17, page 18, all of page 11. I have no time to read this or to really study it to know what's in it or if it's okay. I mean, and even if I've read it, I may not be sure it's okay, but at least it's nice to have an opportunity. This is our last day for committees to meet. I guess what I'm looking for, quite honestly, is an explanation of why do I get an amendment this size on the last day of the committee.
I'm not going to ask you to take a look at or answer that yet. except to say that on the 8th of April, we got a, excuse me, 8th of March, good grief, I hadn't noticed that. We did get a description of a proposed amendment that indicated it was several housekeeping details. And
right.
I don't know if you had a chance to look at that. Or whether this...
Right. Does this match this?
Is there any deviation between this description?
This is just a list of housekeeping details and significant additions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, it's my understanding that with some exceptions and clarification on energy savings performance contract, that it is not a significant deviation from what you see there. The reason why this looks so large is in large part to deal with corrections that's needed by BOLI, because the dealing with adding in the language to forgive me if I don't do this as artfully as I would like to add in the language related to hours of labor and how all that's constructed. There are many different sections that get amended, so it's lengthy, and we apologize for the short period of time. But what the bulk of it does is really reinsert the negotiated language between BOLI and Department of Justice and DAS and all the parties here about how agencies deal with really goods and services contracts as it relates to hours of labor. So the bulk of the amendments deal with that, and it, because of the number of sections of statute that are affected and number of word changes, they look lengthy, but really that's the bulk of the change.
Mr. Chair, if you'd like, I can do about 2 minutes and show exactly what my amendments do. That would be helpful.
Well, I'm going to give Judith a chance to and let me say this. I appreciate Senator Verger's diligence, because she has kept me from making a couple mistakes in the past, and I appreciate that very much. Judith is ready to answer where the changes, first and second changes, are. She's sitting here ready to go. So
right.
let's do that.
And Mr. Gifford can correct me if I'm wrong, but if you look on the original bill, the only difference between the dash ones, which are described there, and now the dash twos, which you have before you, if you look on page 6 of the original bill, line 21, it's taking off the sub 2, so it'll say the addition. So now the new language says energy savings performance contracts entered into in accordance with rules of procedure adopted under ORS 279A.065. It's removing the sub 2, and then it's adding language after that saying public improvement contracts accepted from competitive bid requirements under several of the sections are not subject to the exemption under sub 2. So in other words, the Department of Transportation then in that instance may not exempt a public improvement contract or a class of public improvement contracts from the competitive bidding process. And maybe Mr. Kapori might
Mr. Chair.
So that was my understanding what the difference is with the now the dash twos.
The 279A.065 is not in the bill, so I need to show you what it is that's being changed, why I took the two out.
Now you are referring to this page 501.
I'm referring to the page 501 from ORS.
Okay.
And if you look at page 6, line 21, there's a two been deleted.
Mm-hmm.
The reason why, it talks about energy savings performance contracts entered in accordance with rules of procedure adopted under this statute. This statute has to do with model rules generally. And the sub 2 talks about attorney general shall adopt model rules. But if you look at sub 5 on the second half of the page, about 2 inches down, it says a contracting agency may adopt its own rules of procedure. So I wanted to make it clear that it's not just 279A.065.2, but it's that whole section which includes the ability for a contracting agency to not use the Attorney General's model rules. Now, I've been informed by the people that understand this stuff that that's the way the law says right now already anyway, but it isn't clear. So we're just making it clear that this energy-saving performance contract rules can be done by this whole 279A.065, including the Attorney General's model rules, and if you don't want to use the Attorney General's model rules. Just making it clear, it doesn't change the law. Then, if you look at that Section 12 of the bill, there are two sections there, one and two, and or actually more than that, but it's confusing there. Whether one part relates to the other part, whether you have to have an exemption under the first part and under the second part, or whether an exemption under the first part does not include under the second part. And we want to just make it clear that, you know, it was confusing to me, and I talked to Eric Carlson in the Senate's Democratic office, and who's also a lawyer, and he was confused by it. The people that work with this kind of stuff every day, Dugan Petty, and these people say, no, it's not confusing at all. But to people that don't work with it every day, it was a little confusing. We just wanted to make sure that if you're exempted under one part, you don't have to be exempted on the second part as well. You're exempted for the whole part.
Yes, Senator Berger.
All right. I don't need to look at all of it, but if I could call your attention to page 27, which, of course, gets my attention. It may have started on page 26. Let me see. It's about the Department of Forestry. And about the state lands and the fees and the charges and the changes. At the bottom of page 27, it says, enter into and administer contracts for the sale of timber from lands owned or managed by State Board of Forestry and the State Forestry Department. And then it talks about reforestation. Mr. Kapoor, you may be able to help me with that.
Madam Chair, Senator Verger, no, that's not part of my amendment. And I just had those two little sections. The rest of it is somebody else's work.
Okay. Can you respond as to who's, is that the State Forestry Department's amendments that are in there? Would that refer in any way, or do you know, to energy created by storms and timber that's left on the ground and so forth? Is that connected at all to any of the energy prospects?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, I can't specifically answer if it's related to that. I can tell you that at the time that in the last session that the rewriting of the procurement law took place, we attempted to go out into all the sections of statute that had some contracting practice and bring it into ORS 279 so we could see what was subject to the law, what wasn't subject to law, and have it in one place. And as we did that, working with legislative counsel and the Department of Justice, we found that a lot of the language had been out there for years, and we tried to bring it in and bring it in a way that preserve the status quo of the authorities that they had. Any specific contracting exemptions for certain activities were continued to be preserved.
That's very clear. Thank you very, very much.
Mr. Chair, if I might.
That's a good explanation.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, the only part of here that has to do with energy-saving performance contracts, those are retrofitting, essentially, when you go into a building and change the heating and cooling system, for example, of a building. This other thing hasn't anything to do with energy savings at all, about the forestry.
This is what I was trying to get to, and I understand that's probably all throughout the document. Yes.
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, that is correct. The purpose of this bill is to clean up with the 200-page bill, which is what happened last session,
right?
That there are errors as much as right. We've worked on that thing.
Okay.
And this is meant to correct those errors, not make major policy changes.
Keep the status quo. That knows who's exempt. Okay, I got it.
Thank you.
Very satisfied. Thank you for being patient.
I want to thank you for your diligence. Mm-hmm. I really mean that. I want to thank you a lot for that. Any questions, Senator Jordan?
Okay.
that's the testimony, and I don't want you to leave yet, so stay there. I'd like to close the hearing and open a work session on 2214 and ask Senator George for the dash 2.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman, I move the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2214.
Senator George moves the dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2214. Is there any further questions, comments, any objection? So ordered.
And now, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 2214 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 2214 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any questions? Any comments? So ordered. Okay. The reason I wanted you there, all three of you, please put together a simple floor speech. That's a kind of a consensus floor speech with the three of you, and just get it delivered to my office, and I will attempt to understand what this is all about. Okay? Thank you very much. I have a question, folks. We have a lot to do for the reason we've been taking a lot of time here. We've got six bills. 2352. Listen carefully. 2352 limits requirements that recreational vehicles rented, leased, sold, offered bear insignia of compliance. We've got 2395.
No, that's passed.
Oh, that's passed.
Yeah.
We've got 2474 Department of Administrative Services from charging administrative fee. Libraries, Indian tribes. Urges, and then HCAM 6 urges Congress to amend specific parts of the Internal Revenue Code to allow military veterans. Are there some that you want to hear? Otherwise, I'm just going to move them to rules and let them deal with them. Personally, I guess I'd like to... I just have this soft spot for the Indian tribes, and so I'd like to deal with that one very quickly.
Okay.
And my intention would be to move the rest to rules unless one of you wants... One of them, Senator George.
I'm just looking out here. We have somebody that seems to be.
All right. If somebody wants to rant and rave, I'm not saying the only ones that I'm considering moving. It'll be clear, and the others will remain here in the committee, and I will deal with them one way or another.
Well, Mr. Chairman, I think we're talking about everything dealing with SAFE.
Oh, no. I'm just talking about the ones I've named. Just
okay. Right.
I'm trying to
all
get
right.
us hurried up so we can get the safe.
Okay.
Okay?
Mr. Chairman, I believe that the tribes would like to be able to apply for grants and also make interlibrary loans of books.
Right. And what I want to do...
I think that would...
I want to open a hearing then on House Bill 2674.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. House Bill 2674 adds libraries operated by federally recognized Indian tribes to Oregon Revised Statute list of types of libraries which may apply for and receive grants from the Oregon State Library and to participate in the interlibrary loan program. We have no revenue, no fiscal impact on the measure.
Is Mary Kay here? Come on up, Mary Kay. And what does this say?
Submitted testimony.
Oh, submitted testimony by Melissa Minthorn Winks. Okay. So we've got some written testimony that I've just mentioned on the record.
Mm-hmm.
Go ahead, Mary Kay.
Mr. Chair and members of the committee, my name is Mary Kay Dahlgreen. I'm the Program Manager for Library Development at the Oregon State Library. And I'm here to let you know that the State Library Board of Trustees endorses this bill. And as you said, there's no fiscal impact. This bill adds tribal libraries to the types of libraries that can benefit from state library-sponsored library resource sharing programs. And the three of those that are in statute right now are participate in the statewide cooperative reference services program, which is an online service called LNET, connect to databases licensed under the statewide database licensing program, and participate in statewide courier service, which is currently something that third one is something we're not offering currently, but the other two would include tribal libraries in both of those programs that are funded by the state library.
Okay. Any questions? I have no problem with this.
No.
Let's close the hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2674.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 2674 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Would you like me to
Senator
say that again?
Senator George moves House Bill 2674 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. See, I was able to say it.
That was good. You did well.
Is there any objection? So ordered.
Mr. Chairman, I would just pass a note on 2352.
Yes.
That was indicated.
2352 is going to be real quick.
That could be fast.
2 minutes or less.
All right.
Okay, I'm opening the hearing on 2352. House Bill 2352.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, HB 2352 eliminates a requirement that prior to being leased or sold, certain used recreational vehicles bear an insignia indicating compliance with building code division standards. We have received a no revenue and a minimal fiscal impact on the measure. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Mark, you can go, and then Sean will follow you.
Sure. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mark Long, I'm the Administrator of the State Building Codes Division. This is a bill we worked with the Dealers Association with during the interim. This bill eliminates an unnecessary regulatory requirement that we have to inspect used RVs. When about 5 years ago, we put a process in with the dealers to do quality control, pre-delivery inspection, monitor their facilities. We feel that's adequate, and the inspection of each individual unit in the state prior to sale is unnecessary, and believe this is part of our overall effort to streamline regulations and make it work better, and urge your support of this bill.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Sean Miller here today on behalf of the Oregon Recreational Vehicle Dealers Association. I appreciate working with Mark Long on this particular bill in the interim. It's also supported by the Governor's Streamlining Initiative. It is a good government bill. It still retains the regulatory requirement for the decal inspection on all new RVs. This only deals with RVs. It's an antiquated law, and as the quality control measures that Mark mentioned, it's not needed anymore, and we would urge the committee to move the bill. It passed the House unanimous, and we would ask the committee to pass it to the floor. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair,
yes.
May I ask a question?
Yes. Senator Parker.
I just want to clarify, just for the record and for the public, that this in no way takes any of the safety features away from the sale, any regulations, so you have all the protection of the public that is in place.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, speaking on behalf of my responsibilities, we have all the measures. We've seen no action over the last, I believe it's been 6 years since we implemented this oversight program. We think this is the next reasonable step to take.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Any other questions? There's nobody else to testify, so I'm going to close the hearing on House Bill 2352 and open a work session.
Mr. Chairman, I'd like to move House Bill 2352 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation.
Senator George moves House Bill 2352 to the floor with a do-pass recommendation. Is there any objection? So ordered. And Senator George, you want to carry that?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. This may only save a couple minutes, but how about us moving House Joint Memorial 6 and House Bill 2474 to rules? Is that it? Those are the only two left?
Oh, okay.
Right.
You want to go ahead with the script?
I put the script in a file.
Any problems?
Went away.
When doing that?
Any problems?
Okay.
Senator George or Senator Walker, read the script.
All right, give them to me again.
H.J.M. 6.
H. 6.
And House Bill 2474.
2474. You ready?
Yeah. Mr. Chair, I would move House Bill 2474 and H.J.M. 6 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
Very good. Senator Walker has moved House Bill 2474 and H.J.M. 6 to the floor.
To the floor. That's
without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Okay, that's the way it goes. That's really good. Any objection? If not, so ordered, and the hearings on H.J.M. 6 and House Bill 2474. This means that we can now move into a work session on the SAFE bills, and I notice that almost nobody from SAFE is around here.
That's because they're in the hall.
They're in the hall.
They're
all watching television.
Mr. Chair.
You think they'll be coming in now?
Yeah.
I guess they're coming in now. Yeah, they're coming in now. We're going to take about a 3-minute recess because they were in the hall and some of us want restroom breaks. So about a 3-minute recess, okay? Bring General Government Committee back to order and open a hearing on Senate Bill 310. I just want you to know that it's my intention to stay with the order, even though I don't have it in front of me, of my agenda, which will kind of wrap up 310 and then move to the 984 and then do 1003. We left off the other day kind of asking Senator Starr, who isn't here right now but is in a work group, to do a negotiated settlement on the Dash 8s to Senate Bill 310. And do you want to put them in context? I don't think we need any testimony. It's in fact, people can nod their heads. John and Brenda have talked. They've agreed. And Senator Starr has signed off on these Dash 8s. You all remember from the soap opera last week when we left off? This is...
Actually, Mr. Chair, I think that was just Tuesday.
Yeah.
It was
just
last
Tuesday?
Week. Yeah.
Yeah, well, you know, you want to distance yourself from exciting experiences. I'm just teasing. So the point is, this is where we left kind of Dash 8, and so it's kind of nice to start there, and I'm glad that all parties have agreed. So just to explain the context of this and get us back on the trail here.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. This would be related to Senate Bill 310 with respect to independent audits of contracts, group contracts. So the negotiated language then would create a sub 8 that would say that basically directs the SAFE Corporation to obtain independent audits of the work performed by groups or trade associations under contracts that require payments in excess of $100,000 per year. The audits shall be performed as follows. First of all, groups or trade associations with contracts in effect on the effective date of the Act shall be audited on or before January 1st, 2007. Those, all those in effect now. And that those contracts in effect on January 1st, 2008 shall be audited by January 1st, 2009. And then the negotiated language then goes on to say that the auditor shall be selected from a pre-qualified vendor list maintained by the Department of Administrative Services or otherwise approved by the Audits Division of the Secretary of State.
Is that sinking in? Any questions?
I think that's a good one, Mr. Chair.
Good compromise. Okay, what our procedure has been is if we have a majority that want to send this down to council and get it drafted, that's what we'll do, and it sounds like everybody's in agreement that this will get drafted. Okay? All right, and recognize, as Senator Starr pointed out the other day, some things are already drafted and some aren't, but as we had a note the other day, and again, I commend Senator Verger for her vigilance. She put some things in perspective for me with a little note the other day where she said, you know, I really want to deal with the issues of public records. That was on your list, and that was the next thing on the list after we got the contracts dealt with. And so I want to move through that and into the third point on your list. And given that, let's move to the color-coded copy. And the color-coded copy and section 2, this will be page 2 of 10. I've got extras if you need them. Okay. I just want to make sure everybody has what they need. Okay. I want to make sure everybody is on page 2, section 2. This is page 2 of 10. Section 2, where it says ORS 5 or 656.702.
And
Judith?
Are we all there?
I'm trying to get us all there. Mm-hmm. Now, you have a handout, Judith, of this thing. You were going to make a copy of this? You didn't make a copy.
I'm sorry.
Okay. This morning, we were contacted. What'd you say?
Eric might have it. I didn't get it from him.
No, Eric. Eric was. I asked Eric, and we remembered that you were going to make a copy. SAFE proposes to add the underlined language at the end of sub 1 sub A so that it would read, and you can look there on page 2 of 10 and see what you have to add, the records of the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation are subject to ORS 192.410 to 192.505, except, and this is the new language, that except that the exemption from disclosure specified in 192.501 sub 2 shall not apply to contracts executed by the corporation. Okay? I'll have Judith reread that so everybody has it.
And Mr. Chair, I'm going to need explanation on that because I can't go there.
Okay, we're going to get explanation. Who do you want explanation from?
I want explanation from SAFE Corporation, who is drafting this.
Okay.
And then I'd like Mr. DiLorenzo to be here on the other side to give us counterpoint.
Okay, I'm not going to keep them up here all day like I did the other day, and I want other people to know that they're invited to wave their hands if they really feel strongly about something, too. I will ask them both to come up right now, though, and share with us about this concept that's come forward.
Mr. Chair, would you have Judith read?
Yes.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. And actually, Eric is bringing you the two points that, so you'll have it in writing in front of you in a moment. And this relates, is my understanding, to trade secrets. So it's the new language I'm going to talk about is going to be exempting executed contracts from basically saying that they cannot use the public records law in order to keep those trade secrets within contracts from being disclosed. So it would allow the disclosure of those components of the contract. So it would read then in the color-coded, in your color-coded section 2, 1A, that first section, which relates to public records, we're talking about the records of the State Accident Insurance Fund Corporation are subject to ORS 192.410 to 192.505, so that's the public records law, except, here's the new language, except that the exemption from disclosure specified in 192.501 sub 2 shall not, that's trade secrets, shall not apply to contracts executed by the corporation. So in other words, it would, the state accident insurance funds records would be covered under all of the rules and such of the public records law, except that they will not be subject to the exemption from disclosure with respect to trade secrets on contracts executed.
Okay. Brenda?
Mr. Chair, if I might,
Chris Davey of Safe Corporation, and let me speak to that proposal. This is something that we just suggested a while ago. There have been a number of concerns raised by Mr. DiLorenzo and some others that in the past Safe had relied on, when we thought we were subject to the public records law, that we had relied on an exemption, a conditional exemption in the statute that says that trade secrets need not be disclosed unless the public interest shows that they should be. And that in the past we may have used that in order not to reveal a contract. Ultimately those contracts were all released. But in order to address those concerns, we suggested that if we are to be reattached to the public records law, it could allay those fears that might be used at any point in the future. And so we would explicitly say that SAFE could not rely on the conditional trade secrets exemption in the public records law to prevent the disclosure of any contract that SAFE may enter into. And we felt that that was an appropriate compromise to suggest in order to address some of those concerns.
John, you want to?
Yeah. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I am absolutely opposed to reconnecting SAFE to Chapter 192 at all, and the suggested compromise that I've just heard of now does little to assuage my fears, and I will tell you why. This format would permit SAFE Corporation to invoke the trade secrets exemption and other exemptions designed to keep from public view sensitive documents. To just allow the public to look at contracts doesn't do the trick, because there are drafts of contracts, there are emails that lead up to contracts, there are correspondence that lead up to contracts. If you take a look at tab 2 of the materials which I submitted to you yesterday, there are several examples of documents which prior SAFE management attempted to protect from disclosure under the public records law. The first is a general summary of insurance trends, and SAFE Corporation didn't want anyone to look at it, and so just slapped a disclaimer on that said this memorandum is confidential and exempt from public disclosure pursuant to ORS 192.501-606. If you turn the page, if you have these materials, there was another internal memorandum dated November 8, 2002 called Attack Benchmarks. It was an internal analysis of how SAFE could be attacked by others because it just wasn't doing the job it should have been doing. Now, this is a document that the public should see because it's produced internally. It's produced by an agency of the state. It's critical of that very state agency, and it is our government, and we should have access to it. Yet it's the type of document that was exempt from disclosure under the prior management. I don't believe Ms. Rockland would probably, in her discretion, keep this particular document exempt from disclosure. But again, we should have a rule of law that applies to anyone who happens to be at SAFE Management, not necessarily requiring us to rely on the goodwill of the person who occupies that office at that time. This document would have continued to be exempt from disclosure even under SAFE's purported compromise. I think if we start talking about reconnecting SAFE to Chapter 192, I can tell you, as the litigator who tried the contempt case, that we would have had access to very, very few documents that we ultimately were able to access to show how SAFE Corporation had violated the orders of the court, and to show other disclosures that I think most people view as having been a public service down the line. I am very much against retying SAFE Corporation to Chapter 192. It is a big, big mistake. It is not in the public interest.
Okay. Thank you. Question that arises out of what John just said. Brenda, I've heard you say that the proportion of records delivered to Mr. DiLorenzo just pursuant to the public records law let me pose it as a question. What portion of the records delivered to Mr. DiLorenzo were delivered pursuant to the public relations law, and what proportion were delivered pursuant to the SAFE statute? You have a graph or a chart that you handed out. I'm sure John has seen it. He will probably argue with it in a minute, but at least y'all have this chart? We've got so much paper thrown at it.
No, I don't have my belts with me, Mr. Chairman. I was under the impression we were not hearing SAFE today. So.
Oh, I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's all right. Don't worry about it. I've got them.
You know, you've got enough paper.
I've got it in my hand. It's
the
fine.
Blizzard.
It's fine.
We'll make sure we hand stuff down to you, too.
No, that's fine.
Brenda, go ahead. Or Mr. Davies. Or...
Mr. Chair, for the record, Brenda Rockland, SAFE Corporation. I think the answer to your question is this, Mr. Chair. In terms of the Marion County contempt case, the initial public records request was in 2000. And at that point in time, the Department of Justice and SAFE Corporation assumed that SAFE was under the Oregon Public Records Act, and that had been an assumption for years, since probably 1973 when the Oregon Public Records Act was enacted. Mr. DiLorenzo took the position in that case that SAFE was subject not only to the Public Records Act, but was also subject to a separate statute, 656702. And ultimately, the Marion County Circuit Court concluded that Mr. DiLorenzo's request was under 656702 and that that statute needed to be analyzed separately from the Public Records Act. And, in fact, we turned all of the records over under 656702.
Okay.
That's correct, Mr. Chairman. None of the treasure trove of records that we received were produced under Chapter 192. Had that been the framework, to quote Mr. Harlan Jones from a letter that he sent me, we would have had to pay $80,000 in an upfront fee and not receive the records we really wanted, unquote. So...
Mr. Chair, I think, you know, I'm not going to speak for Harlan Jones, who no longer works at SAFE Corporation, but I think ultimately whether mistakes were made or not in terms of an interpretation under the Public Records Act, many of the documents that Mr. DiLorenzo ultimately received in the contempt case would have been turned over to him under the Oregon Public Records Act, and contracts are a very good example of that. Contracts are simply public records, and they should be turned over under 656702 and under the Public Records Act. And so I disagree with him that he wouldn't have received many of those same records, whether we were under Chapter 192 or Chapter 656. And ultimately, I think, you know, to us, part of the value of being reconnected with the Oregon Public Records Act is that instead of going to court as we did in Marion County, and ultimately that may be the outcome, but the real advantage, I think, for the public and for agencies subject to the Public Records Act is that under the public records law, if there is a dispute, and sometimes there are disputes about whether certain documents are protected or not, that really then is a process that the Oregon Attorney General steps in on and makes a decision on whether the public agency has withheld documents correctly under the Public Records Act. And that's really what we're asking for here, is let's have that reconnect SAFE to the Public Records Act, have that intermediate step available to parties to talk to the Attorney General about disputes, and have that decided without having the more costly and time-consuming process of going directly to court.
Mr. Chairman, there are three reasons why this committee should not reconnect SAFE to the Public Records Act. SAFE makes initially an appealing argument when they say, why shouldn't we be treated like any other state agency? Well, SAFE is different from other state agencies. Number one, SAFE is one of the few state agencies that has its own trade secrets. The trade secrets exemption to the Public Records Act is normally utilized by agencies to protect the trade secrets of those they regulate from disclosure. SAFE says it has its own trade secrets, and because SAFE is the government, that, in my mind, is tantamount to state secrets, number one. Number two, you have, unlike most agencies, no budgetary supervision whatsoever over SAFE Corporation. It seems to me that in the case of Safe Corporation, it would be in the public interest to have an enhanced level of public scrutiny, especially when you have no control over the budget. You want more sunshine on SAFE, not less sunshine. And third, SAFE is the only state agency in the history of the state of Oregon to be held in contempt of court. I think it would be worth this committee's while to keep SAFE under that type of sunshine for at least a while as we see how SAFE reforms itself. A probation of sorts. There is no other agency that has ever committed the types of acts as SAFE has committed. And it seems to me that for all those three reasons, it makes little sense to suggest that SAFE should be entitled to place in force another curtain against public disclosure.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I can't support this proposed amendment. I can't support anything less than the dash 10. I've lived with this case now for a year and a half, and I want transparency in government. I want transparency out of this state agency, and I can't go there. I can't go less than a dash 10. So I'm just laying that on the table.
Okay. I understand that. I'm just trying to figure out what we're sending to the Legislative Council at this point. Senator Verger.
Yes, Mr. Chair, I have a couple of questions for Mr. DiLorenzo. Would you define sensitive materials for me?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, I can't define it. That's the problem with SAFE's proposal. SAFE's proposal in Senate Bill 310 would allow it to keep from the public certain sensitive business records. That's in the eye. They're the beholder of that. I mean, I have no idea what that means. And that term is so broad.
How would you define
a sensitive business record? If I were in business, I would think that my tax returns, for instance, would be a sensitive business record. Okay. The problem we have here with SAFE is suggesting that SAFE, because it also is a private participant in the marketplace, should be entitled to the same privacy protections that private businesses should be entitled to, because they are not private businesses. They are the state of Oregon. They are the government. The problem here is that we are allowing more and more and more through public-private partnerships for the government to become private participants in the marketplace. If we do that, there should be certain constraints placed on government when it privately participates, and one of that should be that they shouldn't have as many privacy interests as private enterprise should have, because there are government. We are their shareholders.
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Senator Berg.
Would you consider PERS to be in the same category?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Verger, it all depends. For instance, a private account statement of a PERS participant, I might consider private. However, data compilations that show the amount of premium that have been paid by local governments, the pay-ins by local governments, and then the amounts received, to me, is a matter of statewide concern, because it is the government. It's the government's pension plan. If it was a private pension plan, I would have a different view. Now, I would say, and this is connected with the answer to this question, the chart that's been submitted, many of these documents would also be protected under the dash 10s. A significant number of them. In fact, Ivan Pink indicated the documents that, in my opinion, would already be protected under the dash 10s. They would not be protected under the current law. And that's why some of these we think are reasonable. For instance, documents that pertain to SAFE's computer programs, or their perimeter security, or the safety of their employees, or the Social Security numbers and addresses of their employees. Many of these things would be protected by the Dash 10. What wouldn't be protected by the Dash 10 are the trade secrets and the sensitive business records that SAFE has historically attempted to withhold from the public.
Follow up, Mr. Chair?
Yeah, except I was going to give Brenda Rockland a chance to respond.
I would like to ask for one more definition.
Okay. Let Brenda respond to what John just said, and then you can ask your next question. Go ahead, Brenda.
I'm just trying to give everybody equal time here.
Mr. Chair, Senator Berger, I want to go back to... I know Mr. DiLorenzo has talked a lot about trade secrets and sensitive business records, and I guess I just want to talk about where I think that is under the public records law, because certainly we've discussed trade secrets, and under the trade secrets exemption, which doesn't mean that any trade secret is absolutely exempted. It just means that it's conditionally exempt, and you can make the case for actually getting even trade secrets under the Public Records Act. But the concern that Mr. DiLorenzo has constantly raised during these committee hearings is really with the contracts, and that's why we've suggested the compromise that we have. But in terms of sensitive business records, and Senator Berger asked a good question about, well, what does that mean? I don't see that in the Public Records Act as to that would apply to Safe Corporation. And if you take a look at the Public Records Act, there is a term, sensitive business records, in that particular act, but it applies specifically to OHSU. And I think there could be a good case made that OHSU as a public corporation is similar to Safe Corporation, and potentially we should be able to protect sensitive business records at Safe Corporation because, again, we're in a competitive environment. But that exception for sensitive business records applies to Oregon Health Sciences University, not to Safe Corporation, and reconnecting us to the Public Records Act is not going to have that section apply to us.
Mr. Chair, if I could add one other thing, too. Mr. DiLorenzo held up this chart with a lot of pink stripes on it, suggesting that the Dash 10 amendments would cover a lot of these items here. When we put this together, we very carefully used what was Senate Bill 507 and is now the Dash 10 amendment to identify in the right-hand column whether these records would be protected in some way under that bill. And you'll see that most of these say none, although Mr. DiLorenzo had them colored in as pink, and I would be very interested to see how he believes that those exemptions really are covered under Dash 10. We don't believe they are.
Okay. Thank you. Senator Verger, you had another question.
SAFE, my question is SAFE a semi-independent agency of the government?
Mr. Chair, Senator Verger, SAFE is neither fish nor fowl. It is what the courts have determined is sui generis. There is none other like it. When SAFE wants to be the government, SAFE freely avails itself of that status. For instance, in the past, parties have sued SAFE for employment discrimination, and SAFE has come into a federal court and taken the position that they are the state of Oregon. And the 11th Amendment, the United States Constitution, prohibits SAFE Corporation from being sued in federal court and under those statutes. On the other hand, when SAFE is at the legislature, and many of us argue that because SAFE is the government, they should be subject to public disclosure, SAFE takes the position, we are a private competitor, and we need to protect our private records. And my rejoinder is, their private records are public records because they are public, not private.
Mr. Chair, if I could respond to that, because I believe that Judge Lipscomb in his ruling, his contempt ruling, ruled that SAFE was a state agency. Is that not correct, Mr. DiLorenzo?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Walker, if Judge Lipscomb did not specifically say it, he certainly assumed it. SAFE is a state agency. SAFE is a state agency in many, many respects. Its employees are part of PERS. It's a state agency, unless SAFE doesn't want to be, in which case then it acts like a private participant.
I would agree with that, Mr. Chair, but I did just want to make that clarification that Judge Lipscomb ruled that they were a state agency.
Mr. Davies.
Mr. Chair and Senator Verger, to respond to that question about what SAFE is, you can read that in the statute. It says that SAFE is an independent public corporation. Those are the words. I can't tell you exactly what that means, but I can tell you that we consider that we are part of the executive branch of government and that we are a state agency, and there is no dispute about that. and as Mr. DiLorenzo referred to, whether we are a state agency and whether our records should be treated as public records, that's simply what we're asking for, that our records should be treated as public records under the public records law.
Okay. Senator George.
Just a really broad question. So if we pass Dash 10 amendments and we pass Senate Bill 310, and they decided it didn't apply to them, would you go to court and fight that? That we didn't have the authority to tell you what to do with this?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, if you passed a law that said that this applied to SAFE, then this applies to SAFE. We would not fight it.
Thanks.
Well, that makes it easy, Mr. Chair. Let's pass the Dash 10.
Well, some people want to, some people don't. And unfortunately, I don't have a whole committee here this afternoon. You know, I always have the option, and I'm going to tell everybody this, I always have the option of saying that we can't resolve. I'm going to pause for a moment. Senator George, Senator Verger.
Excuse us for the sidebar.
That's okay. I just wanted to say that we can move and agree that we don't have agreement on this. What I'm trying to do at this point is I'm trying to sit back, think calmly, find out if among the four, who are now only three, there are three people who want to weigh in on one side or another, and I don't sense that I have three people, I'm excluding myself at this point, that want to weigh in or that have weighed in on the same side. If you were all unanimous in saying that you didn't like this suggestion that has just come forward from SAFE, then I would discard it, but I'm not sure that you're there yet. So I guess we can leave this one go for the moment. What I was going to say was if we have to leave them all go, you know, I might as well send this whole thing to rules and let the rules committee deal with that. But I don't think this committee wants to do that at this point. I may have to get Senator Starr here, and I'm not sure he's even in a building at this point. So if he can't be here to help us break this logjam, I would suggest that we leave this one hang. I will ask the President whether we're going to be allowed to meet again or whether this all gets, by virtue of its very nature, referred to rules. So on the number one item I had on the list, and that has to do with public records, we don't have agreement on page 2 out of 10. There is another piece or two of this first idea, and that would be if you went to page 7 of 10 of, again, 310, the color-coded copy. And I'm going to ask you folks just to step back and give those hot seats a chance to cool off for a while. This part is, you know, the definition of employer account and the definition of claimant files and so on. And again, it may be objectionable to some of us because it's written by SAFE, but there may be other people that want to weigh in on this as well this afternoon. Is there objection to this? Is there support for this piece of the bolded area, of course, is an addition. We know, I'm just going to set this in context, we know what Judge Lipscomb considered an employee account record. The second, it ended up on a spreadsheet, it was no longer an employee account record. Where is the committee on this?
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
I would not support inclusion of paragraph A on page 7. I would let the court decide that issue in the lawsuit of Osette versus Say.
Okay.
I'm sorry, Vicki, I couldn't hear you.
I'm sorry. I said I would not support the inclusion of the bolded section, that I would prefer that the court continue to decide that matter in OSEP versus SAFE.
Here's my dilemma, Mr. Chairman. You have a public agency doing private business. And so you have a schizophrenic animal. And I think that that is very, very difficult, and it's going to come down to probably not as factual a decision as policy that we sometimes read.
That's right.
It's going to come down to a philosophy. And we probably philosophically are going to be quite different. I'd be happy. I did not know that we were going to have the safe hearings today.
I apologize, Josh. I thought when I concluded last week that I said we could carry this over till Thursday.
Yeah, I think I could have misunderstood when I asked the question. But I would be happy to take this over the weekend, sit down, try to figure out exactly where I am, what I would be willing to support and what I would not support. Okay. And if every member wanted to do that, I just am not ready to do that today.
Let me suggest that we might get a little bit of input from some people. And again, I'd like to call Corey Streisinger up to comment both. I mean, this is for your benefit and mine. Mm-hmm. Senator George, I assume, and Senator Walker has already done more research than most of us would ever want to do, probably. On the issue, can you give us just your take from the Insurance Commission perspective on some of this stuff? I'm particularly thinking of page 7 out of 10, and I'm also thinking if you want to go back to the previous compromise, quote unquote, would you like to make some comments for us?
Mr. Chair, for the record, Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And on most of the public records issues, I have no comments to offer. The language in 310 versus the dash 10s. I do have a concern about the issue of the employer account records. And the concern there is with the employers. Employers have a right to have their own histories and information, in my view, treated confidentially, and I think most employers would agree with that as well. And the fact that it is in their insurance company's hands doesn't change their interest in having their own interests of privacy respected. And I have not read the latest ruling from Judge Lipscomb, but I understand that it does, in fact, put those privacy interests of those employers at risk, and in which case there would be, for those employers, a thumb on the scales about their choice of insurance company, unrelated to what insurance product is best for them, but related instead to the fact that if they choose insurance company A, SAFE, their private business is exposed in one way, which it is not exposed if they choose insurance company B. Looking at the interests of the employers, they should be able to choose an insurance company without being concerned that their private business is going to be exposed to public view in that way. I do think, based on my understanding of the ruling from Judge Lipscomb, that clarification of the employer's privacy interests would be useful. And it's my understanding that that's the intent of the language on page 7 of the color-coded 310 version.
Senator George, you have a question.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Unless I'm misreading this, I'm looking at the dash 10 amendments, lines 19, and it says this section of, and I'm assuming it's the right to inspect, does not apply to employer records. Am I reading that right?
But you're looking at the dash 10s, and I'm just looking at page 7 of 10 at the moment.
Mr. Chair, if I could.
Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, Senator George, you're correct. That language, the term employer account records, is the same term that's in the current law that Judge Lipscomb was applying. He applied it, as I understand it, in an extraordinarily narrow way to say that if the information was submitted by an employer and then was in any way manipulated or compiled by SAFE, it lost its protection. So the question is, what does that phrase employer account records mean? the phrase, yes, I think everybody in the room agrees that employer account records should be protected. The question is, what does that phrase mean? And the way Judge Lipscomb interpreted it, and presumably would under the dash 10s without an explanation, is I think, overly narrow.
But couldn't that be follow-up?
Yes.
Couldn't anyone go back to court and try to find another pathway through that and ask for the judge to render a decision relative to final some finer definition?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I believe that is on appeal, but at the moment anyway, that's the ruling. You could, of course, if you choose to proceed in the dash 10 direction, you could take the definitional language and put it into the dash 10s.
Another question.
One more question.
One more.
Then Senator Walker's recommendation is that relative to that definition, we allow the court to make that decision and then we act accordingly. Would that be, that to me is the most reasonable thing to do, path to proceed?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, that's certainly an approach you could take. The concern that I'm expressing is that if the court ruling as it currently stands is upheld, I believe that would put a thumb on the scales for employers making a choice of insurance companies that would be unrelated to what insurance product is best for them. And our goal in administering the workers' comp system is to ensure that employers have a choice of products. And that choice, in my view, should not be artificially influenced by an employer's fear that their private business will be exposed.
At exactly this point, I've sent a note back to Jessica to come up because she represents a lot of employers. I want to find out what your feeling is at this point. Is that okay, Jessica?
Absolutely.
I realize that you weren't given an opportunity to think about testifying or responding ahead of time, but I apologize. Can you,
Mr.
What effects is this going to have? I'm interested in, I want to be fair to all sides here. Tell me what's going on.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Jessica Adamson with AGC, thank you for the opportunity. And though my thoughts aren't fully developed here, I think from the employer side, we're very concerned about the information that's submitted by ourselves and on ourselves, quite frankly, related to our loss history, loss control reports, injuries that happen on our job sites, and quite frankly, claimant files as well. Our employees that get injured and their personal information and medical history that's related to that. And though the Lipscomb decision, we agree, is narrow, I mean, we share the same view that Corey has just outlined. Our fear is that unless it is clarified that it really is a broader information and that information is protected as opposed to the report itself, that if it gets consolidated or changed, unless that is clarified specifically, there is this lingering question out there about what information is available even upon the action here. There was a question about, well, couldn't you go back to court and litigate that? And yes, it's a lengthy process and quite frankly one that leaves employers concerned about their information, and we understand all the concerns about the trade secret and all of that, but I think everyone does agree that information submitted on employers, information submitted on our employees ought to be protected, and that information ought not float out there. And I think without some broader definition about what it means beyond just the phrase itself, and specifically bringing in the concept of information about received about an employer account record and in that context, not unlike what's on page 7 of 10 here, I think that better protects employers and better protects employees, and that's certainly our interest here.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, Senator Walker.
I have, as you can imagine, many, many files on this case, and I have the court's decision in this case somewhere upstairs. Short of taking time to go find that, I think that Mr. DiLorenzo might have a copy of it. I object to Ms. Streisinger saying that the court took an overly narrow view, and I would actually like to know what the court said since we're all talking around it. So I think I would like to hear that, and Mr. DiLorenzo has it in his hand. Otherwise, I can go upstairs and get it myself and read it into the record for the committee.
I'll allow John to come up and read that into the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
What I'm trying to avoid here is a he said, she said, kind of back and forth ping pong game.
Well,
I promise I will.
Mr. Chair, what I'm concerned about is that we're all talking around a court ruling that most of us on the committee don't know what it actually says.
Mr. Chair, Johnny Lorenzo on behalf of OSEP. I believe Ms. Harris has nothing to fear from the court's order. The court said as follows. SAFE is not required to produce to OSEP any records listed on the privilege logs that relate to an employer's account and that were submitted to SAFE by an employer. So that's number one. No need for SAFE to produce any record that an employer has submitted. So those are SAFE. Number two, SAFE is not required to produce to OSEP any records listed on the privilege logs that relate to an employer's account and that were kept by SAFE on an employer-by-employer basis. So in other words, if SAFE has a file on ABC Corporation, it need not produce any of those records. Number three, SAFE is ordered to produce to OSEP all responsive records listed on the privilege logs that were kept by SAFE in the ordinary course of business and that incorporate data derived from employee account records. Examples of such responsive documents include, without limitation, lists of dividends paid by SAFE to employers and lists of premiums paid by employers to SAFE, whether in tabular form or otherwise. And then finally, SAFE is ordered to produce to OSEP all responsive records listed on the privilege logs that relate to SAFE's internal activities, including without limitation marketing records, correspondence among employees of SAFE, and internal memoranda created by SAFE employees, but not including such documents as described in paragraph 5.
Senator George.
Well, I want to go back to the dash 10 amendments again. I want to ask this question of Jessica. When you look at basically lines 6 through 11 on page 2 of this, it talks about the fact that before these records could be disclosed, there would have to be this necessary standard met of public interest with convincing evidence. And then it says this, the party seeking disclosure shall have the burden to show that the public disclosure would not constitute unreasonable invasion of privacy. With that in mind, it would appear to me that it would require the person that was seeking to get the information to in fact prove that it was not going, that this disclosure would not constitute invasion of that of any interest, and of, well, of particularly in the area of medical records, and of course this follows the section talking about claimant files and employer accounts. I don't know how you could write it any more tight. Do you believe that that would cover everything that you're concerned about?
Mr. Chair, Senator George, I'm not sure, but I guess from my perspective, I would feel better, I think employers would feel better, if the definition of employer account records were more than just the listing that employer account records fall under that, but perhaps something broader that talks about what that means, what a claimant file means in a broader sense. We would feel more comfortable with that.
I'm going to invite SAFE's attorney Bill Gary come up to respond to that.
Do you want me to say?
You can say.
Okay.
It's at least a different configuration.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. My name is Bill Gary. I'm with the law firm of Horang Long Gary Rudnick, and I am a special assistant attorney general representing SAFE Corporation in the OSEP litigation. Mr. DiLorenzo and my office worked out the language that he read to you, which, if Judge Lipscomb ultimately signs it, will be the final directory language in the judgment that Judge Lipscomb will enter. The problem, from SAFE's perspective, with the interpretation of employer account records that Judge Lipscomb rendered is that it, whether the document is protected or not depends first and foremost upon the form in which it is kept at Safe Corporation. As Mr. DiLorenzo's rendering of the judgment tells you, if it's a document that was sent to Safe Corporation by an employer, it would be exempt. So, for example, if an employer writes to Safe Corporation and says, I don't understand why you canceled my policy or why you raised my premium, that would be a protected record. However, if an employee of Safe Corporation writes back to that employer and says, the reason we canceled your policy or raised your premium is because you do a lousy job of protecting your employees and you're a lousy employer and you need to clean up your act, that letter would not, I'm sure Safe wouldn't be so impolitic, but that letter containing the very same information would not be protected. At least it would not be protected under Judge Lipscomb's ruling unless it was kept in a file called the Acme Corporation account file. We live in the 21st century. Safe Corporation is an extremely automated company. Almost all of their data is maintained in a computer. And how that data is produced depends upon how you manipulate the data. So if Safe Corporation, for whatever internal reason, decides they want to see the list of the 100 top employers in terms of accident rate or claim rate, and they spit out a list from the computer that says Acme Corporation had more injuries on the job per employer day worked than any other employer in the state of Oregon under Judge Lipscomb's ruling, that would not be protected as an employer account record. The very kind of highly sensitive information that employers are required to give to any workers' compensation insurer in order for the insurer to provide the coverage that they need under the law would not be protected unless Safe Corporation managed its files in a way that is inconsistent with the way the Safe, or for that matter any other insurer, does business in this day and age. And it's a distinction that, if you think about it, doesn't make any sense. If the goal is to protect the sensitive information belonging to employers about employers that Safe Corporation will have in its records, it shouldn't matter where in Safe Corporation's records that information can be found. And so it was our view that the court did take an unduly narrow view of the interpretation of employer account record, one that we don't think is supported by the legislative history of what this body intended when it put that exemption from disclosure in ORS 656.702 in the first place. And let me close with just one last observation, which is that Senator Walker has suggested that the court really ought to be allowed to, this ought to be litigated and let the court issue a final decision. Whatever this body does, the proposal that you have in front of you that you're looking at now would not affect the outcome of that litigation. It would apply to requests made from the date that the legislation becomes effective going forward. So this is not an attempt by Safe Corporation to change the outcome of the litigation with respect to what records Mr. DiLorenzo gets and what he doesn't. We're perfectly happy to let it litigation run its course, and we'll live with the outcome of that litigation with respect to that specific case. The question for you is the outcome of that case good public policy? And if you don't think it is, then I think it does make sense for you to take some corrective action for the future.
I guess I asked for it, more input, right? We got more input, which means we got more to think about and wrestle with over the weekend or whatever. I don't think we're going to get through or be able to make any decisions, especially with Senator Starr absent. I mean, there's some stuff that's easy in here. Senator Walker's material back on pages 9 and 10, which are part of her Dash 11 amendments, that's pretty easy stuff. In my humble opinion, what Senator Morris suggested on page 8 of 10 might not be too complicated. I don't know. But I've got to the point where I've decided I'm not going to second-guess anything here. I just want to run a fair hearing. What I think I should do as chair is to honor what Senator Verger said, and that is give you the weekend to read and study and be ready to decide what you want to do, not only with Senate Bill 310, but with Senate Bill 984. I think that's fairly easy, and I think everybody kind of agrees on that one. The assigned risk plan. Everybody's... Go ahead.
Mr. Chair, I think we should at least open a hearing on 984 and have a discussion about that. But what before you do that, if I wouldn't mind sharing with my colleagues here what I like and don't like about 310, just to let you know where I'm going, and if you have opinions about that, I'd love to hear them. So
if the committee wants to do that, that's fine by me.
Here's my dilemma.
Right.
In Senate District 5, Senate District, House District 9, I had several hundred safe businesses.
Mm-hmm.
In Senate District 5, I have at least double the number. When the vote was taken as to whether people wanted to keep safe or not, overwhelmingly in my district, I owe these employers consideration if I'm going to sit here and vote for them. That's why I'm here.
Mm-hmm.
And so I'm going to do due diligence. I'm going to talk with some of them. But the thought of, and I am one of the employers, and I want to disclaim that.
Right.
But I also am telling you that I'm joined by hundreds up and down the coast. And I think to ignore the business community to that extent would be totally irresponsible of me as a senator.
I appreciate what you're saying. I have appreciated and listened to what Senator George has said this afternoon and Senator Walker. I miss very much Senator Starr's input on this whole issue. It's when I end up with a 2-2 tie between the four of you that I have to weigh in, and I haven't done that too often on this. I'm trying to push us in directions of consensus. Again, if we totally break down, we can dump this all in the lap of the Rules Committee. I don't think you want to do that, and so I'm going to ask each of you to appeal to the President to allow us to meet again on this issue. Senator Walker is welcome to share where she wants to be on this if you all want to go through it. And I'm going to ask somebody to get me a special colored pen so I can mark down Senator Walker's comments in a distinctive color or something so I have them on my copy. Okay? If we can do that, that would be of help to me.
And if I would love to hear where other members of the committee are, and
I guess what I'm saying is
that helps in the deliberation.
Yeah, and Senator Verger's already said that she wants the weekend to think about it.
Sure, I mean I didn't expect we'd resolve this today.
Okay, let's let Senator Walker comment, if she would, on where she is, and she can just take us through hers. I'll let all you sit back because we're not going anywhere. We'll be back, it looks like. So let's go. Vicki, Senator Walker, go ahead for, I don't know, as many minutes as it takes. But
okay,
move
it won't take very long, Mr. Chair. I'll just tell you what I'm okay with and what I'm not okay with, and I'd love to hear from you all. If you just take the first page, the first bolded section, I thought we talked about that a little
bit.
Yeah,
we've done that.
Last week, and we've done that, so I'm all okay with that. Section 7, the next bolded section, we've replaced the dash 8s there with 7. Then my green part,
right.
We've done that.
This is the new dash 8s bolded.
And I made a...
New dash 8s go where?
Replace on page 1 of 10, the sub 7, bolded language.
This is the new
audit.
Dash 8s.
Okay.
On the audit. The new dash 8s would fit right there.
Okay.
And my color copy, I don't know what I did with it. I photocopied this, so I don't have my colors anymore. But oh, that'll help me, Judith. Thank you. Okay, so we've got the first page taken care of. The second page, we've been talking about that. I don't support the section 2 and would support the dash 10. Section 3, I think all of that's good stuff. That's in the blue, includes the blue with Senator Esquivel. But I must tell you that I've got a bill this session that seems to be moving as soon as I can get my memo prepared on the executive appointments process, and we will be addressing geographic diversity in that bill as well. So it could be end up being redundant. On page 3, section 4, I am okay with all that. And page 4, the bolded Department of Justice section, I'm okay with that. Section 5, Safe Corporation, actually, believe it or not, I'm okay with that. Section 4, right there on page 4, the next bolded section, well, that's part of my dash 11, so we don't need to worry about that. Section 6, I am opposed. That's all part of what we've been discussing about the public records piece. And then the next page we would be discussing, because I don't approve any of those things up through all those pages.
7 of 10, of course, you're against.
And then 7 of 10, I'm opposed to. And then the following page, page 8, I don't, as much as I love Senator Morris, I don't like that amendment either. Page 9, the section 8, the bold, I'm okay with that. And, of course,
that's
the...
That's part of your dash 11s.
Eight. And then section 8, that's part of my dash 11. So then we get to the last page, page 10. I would like to add the dash 4 amendments here with regard to sovereign immunity.
Where is that?
The dash 4 amendment is...
what I'm saying is, you mean
within
here?
This section on page 10.
Within 11 you want 4.
Yes.
Okay, that's... is that the conclusion of your perspective?
No, one more piece. We talked a little bit about the dash 7s, quite a bit of it about the dash 7s on Tuesday and the dash 9s, and I still think the dash 7s would be good with... some clarification that we talked about, the modification we talked about. I think it's important that all the group plans that are offered by Safe Corporation are based on objective criteria rather than subjective criteria, and that's why I would support the dash 7s or some variation thereof, and that would be included in that section somewhere. And
That dash 7, is that the sovereign immunity?
The dash 4 is the sovereign
the dash
immunity,
4.
Mr. Chair.
I wanted to make a comment based on, and please hear me, folks, based on the discussion on Tuesday, I wrote a note to Senator Burdick about the sovereign immunity issue and wanted to know whether why she hadn't scheduled Senate Bill 989 to deal with the contempt power of the courts as it applies to state agencies generally. And she said that she hadn't scheduled it because nobody was advocating for it. That's all. We have busy schedules around here, and if nobody's yelling at you to do something, sometimes you don't do it. And she did say that she would be glad to hear the bill if you want the broader issue addressed. Let me hand the handwritten note at the bottom in response. So, you know, if some of you want to holler about that a little bit, if you want to hear that, that's just one issue that I wanted you to be aware of.
Okay. Senator Burdick just probably forgot, but I had asked Mr. DiLorenzo to talk to her about it, and I think that he did. But if she's forgotten, that's okay, because we all have a lot of bills.
No kidding. Funny thing.
Okay, Mr. Chair, completes my review. And if any of you all have some comments, I would love to hear them.
And I think that we do have comments. We'd all probably want to go through it the same way as Senator Walker, but I don't know that we want to do it at 5:45 this evening. Okay? Because Senator Verger's already said she wants to go through it, and okay. I'm trying to limit myself to about 2 hours of this kind of intensity at once. Although there is some unfinished business, I want to return us to our agenda. I'm going to close the hearing on Senate Bill 310, and we're not going to... Well, let me ask a question about 984. Is everybody in agreement? Is everybody okay with 984, Senate Bill 984, dash?
No, these are just conceptual.
There's real amendments to 984.
Yes, there is, and they're actually, the person that got them done was yourself. This letter, which deals with 984, conceptually, actually, Senator Walker took it and already had it drafted up.
Well,
right?
Mr. Chair, to be clear, Senate Bill 984-1 is my Senate Bill 751 that was sitting in the Commerce Committee. And that's what I have drafted into the
Corey,
first one.
Come on up.
And Mr. Bowe is here to address Senate Bill 984 as well.
Well, okay. See, I didn't want to start a whole bunch of more hearings because I don't want to go quick comment.
Mr. Chair, the dash ones include your Senate Bill 751 and quite a bit of additional material.
Okay.
There is also a conceptual amendment, which is not an LC form, which we put forward, which includes, in essence, just your 751 plus one small additional piece that we believe everybody is in agreement with. The dash ones go further than the conceptual piece that I have and I'm happy to hand out. So there is not, there. I believe, let me...
Brian, you might as well come on up very quickly, too.
I don't want to speak for Brian. I believe that nobody would disagree with the conceptual amendment that's being handed out now, but that Mr. Bowe would like to go further. And I'm happy to talk about the issues and differences if you'd like, but I wanted to get clear where we are.
Okay. Mr. Bowe, why don't you hand those to staff over there, and let's get those handed out, too, huh?
Those are just the
dash ones.
We have dash ones already. Okay.
So the dash ones and my handout are not the same. They have a lot of the same content in them, though, and both of them include the 751 content.
Okay.
A quick comment about them?
Yes.
I mean, this is for us to think about over whatever number of days.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I appreciate a chance to finally get up and talk about this bill. It's been on the agenda, and we've kind of been rolling it forward for a long time. I will hand one more document to the staff that's here with me. Mr. Chair, for the record, Brian Bowe, representing Liberty Northwest Insurance. The 984-1s basically reflect the discussions in those negotiations, if you will, that the chair requested take place on early on in this process. When representatives from Liberty and SAFE, facilitated by Ms. Streisinger and DCBS staff, sat down to talk about if there might be common ground on some of these issues. And they reflect two areas that we discussed. And really it brings us back around full circle to where, from Liberty Northwest perspective, where we started this when we came to the committee and said we have got some basic concerns that we would like to address, that we think are legitimate to address in this environment, after the ballot measure has been decided, after there's been a public outcry over certain practices at SAFE, and these areas where there needs to be a refinement and further specificity in public policy as it relates to the public insurer. The first subject matter is the assigned risk pool. Now, our issue with the assigned risk pool was that there had been a wholesale shift. As you'll recall, at the beginning of the hearings, Mr. Chair, I handed out a chart, and I've got it again if anybody doesn't have it in their file, that showed in 1990, SAFE made a drastic change in their orientation and how they handled the assigned risk pool. This received a lot of notoriety in the press back then. Mr. Long, who was this then CEO of SAFE, canceled 10,000 small businesses. And what you see happened at that time period is the population of Oregon's assigned risk pool shot up dramatically by about 10,000. And it's never really returned to those pre-1990s levels. It spiked up and below that point, and right now stands at about, there's about 12,600 Oregon employers in the assigned risk pool. Now, it's a bit of an anomaly as you look at it, because the other chart and the other information that I gave the committee shows that out of all the states, 28 states have no state insurer, 18 states do. Of those 18 states, 14 of those state funds act as the insurer of last resort. They insure the entire, what we call the assigned risk pool here. Only four states have a state fund plus an assigned risk pool. Now, the reason that that's interesting and the new information that I wanted to hand out to the committee, and as it relates to the Dash 1 amendments, and I'll get to that in a second, but just let me favor you with the additional information that I found here, is I was curious about the size of those assigned risk pools in those four other states that have a state fund plus an assigned risk pool. If you look in the chart that I gave you, assigned risk pool comparisons, Arizona, Idaho, Oregon, New Mexico, you see that out of a state the size of Arizona, there's only 356 employers. There's a typo. That column says employees in assigned risk pool. It should say employers. There's only 356 employers in the assigned risk pool, and that's one half of 1% of the total market. In Idaho, there's 705 employers in the assigned risk pool, 1.7% of the total market. In Oregon, there's 12,601 employers in the assigned risk pool. That's 16.7% of the total market. And in one other state that has this unique configuration, New Mexico, there's 4,282 employers in the assigned risk pool, a total of 17.8% of the market. But there's an important distinction, and I just found this out today, and that's why I wanted to share it. That the New Mexico State Fund is chartered as a mutual insurance company, and it's subject to all of, applicable regulations and taxes, including federal income tax. So they truly do operate as a private mutual insurance company with a state charter. And they are on complete parity with the private competitors in New Mexico because they're paying federal income tax. As you know from our original discussion, SAFE Corporation does not pay federal income tax.
One part I wish that was in here is how much workers' comp costs in each of those states.
Right on.
You can find those comparisons. I think Gore's, and I think they rank relatively low. You know, and my comment would be, Mr. Chair, is what drives the cost of workers' comp are the benefit levels that are established in statute. Oregon had exorbitantly high workers' comp rates prior to 1990 special sessions when the Mahonia-Hall reforms were adopted, and our rates came down dramatically after that. And I think anyone with any kind of professional credentials in insurance probably would agree with me that is by far and away the major driver, is the benefit levels that insurers are required to pay. Rates are driven by losses. Losses are, the benefits are specified in statute.
But when we become safer, that also affects that cost factor. You know, I'm just adding that into the mix.
It does. And, you know, and a big part of those Mahonia-Hall reforms were the changes in workplace safety, mandatory safety committees, and a lot of things. A lot of good came out of that, and Oregon experienced the benefit of that in the low rates that we have today. So, again, where we started was, our proposal was, if we're going to have a state-chartered insurer here, and it's going to be exempt from federal income tax, they should have a specific public purpose and public mission, and that should be defined in statute. In virtually every other state, with these very few exceptions here, that is, the state insurer acts as the insurer of last resort. Safe Corporation, in the wisdom of the legislature in past years gone by, got out of that arrangement, got out of that requirement. And we would like to see, we think it's legitimate, to get parity between, you know, the entities here, and that's what we're looking for, a level playing field, that if the state is going to be in the insurance business, just like if they were in any other private endeavor, they would have to have a specific purpose and mission for being in that private enterprise. And that should be a greater responsibility for those employers who have trouble finding insurance. Now, we started out in 94 saying, let's just set up a criteria. Set up a criterion statute, and if you don't meet that criteria, then SAFE has to insure you. If you fall outside that, you can go in the assigned risk pool. SAFE objected to that. Ms. Streisinger and the department raised a lot of concerns. They were concerns about potential adverse impacts that would be unknown that if we just made such a wholesale shift. And so, as a part of these discussions over there, we talked about the concept that's contained in the Dash 1 amendments. And that is, DCBS will conduct a study, and they'll determine why Oregon has these sort of unique statistics, why there are such a high rate of employers in the pool, study some other aspects about it. Once that study is completed, then Safe Corporation would be required to respond to that study to DCBS and the legislature with a plan to address Oregon's inordinately high population of employers in the assigned risk pool. Now, that was the compromise. We agreed to that. I'm not trying to speak for anybody else. I'm just speaking for Liberty Northwest. We agreed to that as being a reasonable compromise from where we started, which was saying if the state's going to be in this business, they should have to insure everybody or have a darn good reason not to. To let's study it. We'll have an independent party look at it, come back with a report, Safe response to the report, and then the next legislature, will be the ultimate judge of whether that was an adequate response or not, or whether something else needed to be done. Okay, quickly, and I'll conclude very, very quickly. The second portion of the bill, Mr. Chair, has to do with something that is very important to us, and it's about objectivity in rates, in rate setting. And this is a little bit technical, but what we're seeking to prevent here, to be candid with you, is unfair discrimination in the assignment of rate tiers to employers as they seek insurance. And the way that we seek to address that is to ensure, by writing this second section in the 984-1 amendments into statute, that the assignment of rates must be based on objective data to the greatest degree possible. And that what that precludes, or what we're trying to get around there, is that there can be no favoritism in the assignment of rates. And this portion of this statute would apply to all insurers. This isn't something we're saying, well, they have to be objective, but we can be subjective. It would ensure greater objectivity on the part of all insurers and for all employers, that as they prepare those rates and they go through their underwriting exercise to assign a rate, that they have to ensure that the factors that they're crediting and towards that employer account are based on objective data, not subjective data, not things like, well, we like them, they're a big employer with a lot of political influence, so let's give them a good rate, or, you know, if for any other reason. That when Ms. Streisinger and her bureau comes and does a market conduct study and they look through those files, they'd have to open them up, and they would look at how those rates were arrived at and established, and they would have to be done on an objective basis, not on a subjective basis. I will tell you, Safe Corporation doesn't like this amendment because they feel it unduly limits their underwriters from applying factors that they would use that somehow fall outside the objective realm, but they feel are nonetheless, legitimate and should be applied. We believe it's better to err on the side of objectivity. And we believe, and I'll tell you, from Liberty Northwest's unique perspective in this as being the last private competitor active in this market and wanting to stay that way, this is very, very important to us in terms of having a level playing field that everybody has to underwrite on the same basis. Everybody has to establish rates based on objective criteria to the greatest degree possible, and that's the basis on which we compete. And we believe that this amendment would go a long way towards ensuring that that's how its business is conducted in Oregon. And so I commend it to your consideration, and I hope that you'll adopt it.
Brian, I appreciate your sharing. All of this is more information for us. Corey, I don't know if you're in a position where you want to make any comments this afternoon or...
Mr. Chair, just briefly, if I could.
All right.
Corey Streisinger, Director of the Department of Consumer and Business Services. And I want to address a couple things. As Mr. Bowe said, both the issues about the assigned risk pool and the issues about rating structures received a great deal of discussion in the meetings that I facilitated, and I think both Liberty and SAFE did an honest job of trying to reach agreement. There was no agreement reached. What you see in the conceptual amendment that you have in front of you are the parts which I think there was agreement reached. The study portion is essentially the same from 751. Portion which relating to the assigned risk pool, which is not in the conceptual amendment but which is in the dash one, first of all, is the dash one has a much shorter time frame for that study, and then also requires SAFE to take some action steps prior to the commencement of the next legislative session. And I'll let SAFE address those issues if it chooses to do so, but the study portion is something that we feel is important. Frankly, we'd like to have a longer time to do it, all other things being equal. I will also say that the assigned risk pool, people in the assigned risk pool are handled by servicing carriers, and we issue a request for proposals on every 3 years generally for servicing carriers. Both Liberty and SAFE serve as servicing carriers, and we're in the process of issuing that RFP now. So there again, the compressed time frame does raise some concerns because we kind of have several things going on with the assigned risk pool at the same time. But the assigned risk pool is something which we definitely think needs a close look. That would happen under either versions of these. And one of the reasons that we found when we did a very preliminary look, which we presented to the Interim General Government Committee, is that Oregon, through legislative action in the past, has put in place a number of discounts which make the assigned risk pool often a less expensive place to be for small business. And that's we don't want to do something that would harm those small businesses inadvertently. So that's why I think everybody agreed what we really need to do is take a good hard look at how the assigned risk pool functions and then bring recommendations back. With respect to the other issue, which is in the Dash 1 amendments regarding ratings, this is a very technical subject. We spent a lot of time discussing it. There were plenty of times when most people in the room had no idea what was being discussed, and the actuaries were the only ones who did understand what was being discussed. I put myself in the category of people who didn't understand what was being discussed in some of those technical discussions. But everybody concluded that what really needed to happen is this issue needed to be addressed by rule. And the Dash 1 amendments and the conceptual amendments both have the Department addressing it by rule. What the Dash 1 amendments do is set out some fairly detailed parameters for how that rulemaking proceeding would go forward, and they do address some philosophical differences in how insurance companies slice and dice when they're making rates. And let me use the auto insurance as a rough example. This, it's not the same in any way as workers' comp. There's some companies that just use a couple of factors in setting rates, and there's others that use a broad variety of factors. So there can be different rate-making approaches. And the Dash 1 amendments are an attempt to sort of push the market toward a particular model. And some insurance companies use that model and some don't. We do have other insurance carriers in the state of Oregon. We'd like to see more of them. So none of those other insurance carriers were in the room. Rulemaking proceeding allows a variety of carriers, if they choose to do so, to weigh in on these issues. The We do have the ability to address these issues by rule now. There is one area, though, that we don't have the ability to address by rule, and in the conceptual amendment it would be added, and that is the ability to make these rate filings public. They're currently not public, and we believe that we should have the ability to make them public. Again, that's something we'd like to address in rulemaking, because there may be issues with respect to certain insurance carriers as to why certain aspects of their rate filings shouldn't be public. But the Section 4, which is on the second page of the conceptual amendment, would give us that statutory ability, which we don't have today.
And, Mr. Chair, that's not in the Dash 1, correct? That's Section 4.
Mr. Chair, Senator Walker, I believe that it is also in the Dash 1. Uh-huh. And as I say, the Dash 1s go further than the conceptual amendment. Brian, maybe you can point your finger to it.
Well, he has drafted the language, though. If you wanted, I'm sure he's
referring to it. Yes, it is on page 3, lines 10 through 12, would make rate filings open to the public immediately upon approval.
Okay.
Okay, I'll tell you what. We've probably absorbed as much as we can on 984 for tonight. We're all going to keep studying. I'm going to talk to Senator Starr. What I'd like to say to you folks is you each need to appeal to the president, it would occur to me, if you want us to get back together, because this is shutdown time for our committee. What it seems to me is that we still have work to do on the three bills that are here, 310, Senate Bill 984, Senate Bill 1003, and we'll appeal to the president to see if we can continue this work.
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Could I just at least give a brief moment about what
okay.
Senate Bill 1003
okay.
does?
I haven't closed the hearing on Senate Bill 984 yet. And there's one thing I want to do first, and then I'll give you that. And that is, I had a bill early today, and I just want to tell you, I wasn't here. Senator George, I want to thank you for chairing before I got here. I am still trying to limit my energy consumption. So I made a deliberate decision to ask you to chair for the first 45 minutes or so, and I appreciate your doing that very much. But as I was walking into committee, I became aware that lots of lobbyists for lots of telephone companies were in here dumping all over Senate Bill 1031, which just happens to be my bill. Now they're all home at dinner, and a citizen is sitting in the back of the room
right.
who just really thought that the blue pages was worth another look. Mm-hmm. So what I'd like to ask you to do, folks, is at least move that over to rules before we adjourn, if that's okay with you folks.
I'm fine with that.
Okay? And we will, there's no way we can. I know that Senator Starr in previous sessions was quite supportive of the issue.
Mm-hmm.
He's not here, and you were quite supportive, and I'm supportive. But I think there was some real confusion around all the big guns that were here. So at least let's move that to. So we've adjourned everything. Can you let's open a work session on Senate Bill 1031.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I would recommend that we move Senate Bill 1031 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules.
You got to have that script. That is too long for me to remember. Okay, Senator George moves Senate Bill 1031 to the floor without recommendation as to passage, and the bill be referred to the Committee on Rules. Is there any objection?
No.
Any discussion? Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered. Thank you for that. Now, we're going to open a hearing. A hearing, that's all it's going to be. I guess it says work session. So we're opening a work session on Senate Bill 1003 so that Senator Walker can explain her ideas therein. She's going to do that very quickly because some of us are beginning to fade.
Thank
right?
you.
You might have to explain it again when some of us have our mental faculties back.
Yeah, well, Mr. Chair, since Senator Verger wanted to review some things over the weekend, I thought I'd just like to give her information about what these are. So I will try and explain that. I've had this bill down here so many darn times. Let me see. Okay. The Dash 1 amendments, actually what Senate Bill 1003 is it was a placeholder bill. If you see, the relating clause is relating to workers' comp. I had that bill drafted so that I could use it as a dumping ground for any bill that didn't get a hearing somewhere else. So, colleagues, that's what it's here for. Senate Bill 1003, I had three amendments drafted. The Dash 1 amendment is my Senate Bill 754. The Dash 2 amendment is my Senate Bill 753. And actually, the Dash 1 is my 551. And the Dash 3 is my Senate Bill 754. Let me just go over those very briefly.
What's the third one? 754 and
754.
And 753.
Uh-huh. 753 is the Dash 2.
Right.
754 is the Dash 3. And 551 is the Dash 1.
Okay.
The Dash 1, 551 was related to an injured worker's Bill of Rights, and I thought that that was important for us to review and establish. I sensed that it was going to be a longer bill that was going to take a great deal of time, so I don't even think we're going to get to that. But, golly, I think we ought to be taking a look at an injured worker's Bill of Rights, and we should probably look at that at the interim. The Dash 2 amendment, which was Senate Bill 753, was my revision of MLAC. I spoke to the speaker about this sometime after the session started. She wasn't too keen on it. So this, again, is another bill that I think needs work in the interim because I don't like the way MLAC is comprised now and think it needs to be reviewed and revised. And I would hope that we can do that in the interim. The Dash 3 amendment is the one that was actually one of my priority bills for the session. And, Mr. Chair, this would require a study of the cost shifting on the denial of workers' comp claims. I provided to you last Tuesday documentation, you recall getting this, which indicated that this was an issue as soon as Safe Corporation was cut loose with the reforms and they started whacking away at the folks in the plan and the injured workers. They were denying claims right and left. Workers were complaining about it. Then Insurance Commissioner Ted Kulongoski didn't really take the issue up. So when Gary Weeks became insurance commissioner, he commenced a study to see if that was happening, and indeed it was. And so an interim committee in March of 1992, the Senate Committee on Labor, and I provided you with those documents from the Archives Division, indicated that this was a serious issue, and they talked at length about the cost shifting that they believe was occurring in the market. So when Safe was denying a claim, or any carrier for that matter, was denying a claim for compensability under the workers' comp code, then that worker had to then go out into their private insurance, if they were lucky enough to have private insurance, to get coverage for the claim. If they didn't have private insurance, then guess what, folks? They get dumped into the Oregon Health Plan or Medicaid or any other service that they can find, or they get charity care. So this issue was discussed in 92. I believe it's important to discuss it now. If Mr. Schultz, I'd like to call him up and testify at another time because we're trying to close this down tonight. But I would ask him questions like, has a study like this been done before? And I think he can address that. And have you done studies with outside researchers before? And what advantages do you think there might be to this kind of a study? The study's not in the governor's recommended budget, but it doesn't come from general fund. It comes from the workers' benefit fund. I think Since we're talking about studying the assigned risk pool and all those people that are in there that probably shouldn't be, we also ought to be taking a darn close look at who's being denied claims under the workers' comp code. So, Mr. Chair, this was really important to me. I think it's really important to the state, and that's sort of what I had 1003 drafted, just in case what happened did happen, but I didn't get a hearing on that bill.
Yes. May I respond, Mr. Chair?
Yes. Senator
Walker, I want to thank you very much. I want to go back to one thing you said, though, on the assigned risk pool. I think that there could be some logical reasons for the inflated number. I think we should wait and see what those reasons might be. The other thing is, the thing that bothers me about this the most, and I in no way disparage the Department of Consumer and Business Services. On the other hand, they have been a part of a process and looking at a process that has been, in my opinion, miserable for workers. So how we really get to exactly what you're trying to do, and that is, I used to get so many complaints, and they were all the same thing. They weren't people that were just coming at me from 10 different ways. They run people in, I've shared this with Corey, I've shared it with others. They run people from Coos Bay to the Valley to see a doctor. If that doctor, if you don't think that that's the right thing and you want to see another doctor, you've got to go back. These people are unemployed. They don't have a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
It is a bad process. And I don't know what, if you feel comfortable that this gets to it. Or if you feel better that it, you go through your individual bills. What do you think on that? Which is the strongest? Because I really think that we need to get at the heart of the matter. Now, I will tell you, each time I have turned over someone's case, they've been actively trying to help it. But I think the process needs to be streamlined and improved and far more sensitive. I'm not familiar with the Injured Workers Bill of Rights. I will take a look at that.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe that's a good start. But I'm just looking. You have three bills. And so explain to me, suppose those three bills passed. Are you saying those won't pass, but Senate Bill 1003 would take care of all of them at one swoop?
Yes, Senator Verger, the three bills that are the Dash 1, Dash 2, and Dash 3 amendments were bills that didn't get hearings in Commerce.
Okay.
And they were important bills, I thought, mm-hmm. in my 10-point plan that I outlined before session began about the reform I'd like to see. Unfortunately, we are so late into the session that a discussion about the makeup of MWEC, we won't get there. And I knew that was going to happen because we waited so long to get to it. The Speaker also indicated she wasn't quite there with that. So that's kind of an issue I hope that the interim committee takes up, because the bill that I had drafted is patterned after the New Jersey model, and that was one of the first and the oldest MWECs in the nation. The other bill, the Injured Worker Bill of Rights, it addresses the issue you talked about how the workers have been treated. The injured workers really would like to have something like that. Again, that's probably something that takes a lot of discussion. But this one, the Dash 3 amendment, the cost-shifting study, there's no reason why we can't do that now. They talked about it then. We should have done it now. I contacted all the carriers, the lobbyists who represented private insurance companies. I said, you should be interested in this bill. Well, they were here Tuesday, but it's 6:15 and they're not in the room now that I can see. But I think they're concerned about it, and we're concerned about the cost of health insurance and the rates that have gone up, and people and employers can't afford it. Well, I think what's happened is the workers' comp rates have stayed low because they've shifted the cost into the other market. They deny a claim, and that person then has to go to their private insurance carrier. So maybe I'm wrong, But I think it's been something that's been going on since the reforms, and the worker benefit fund is set to pay for those kinds of things, but we have to allow it by statute. I asked the department if they could conduct that study, and they can't do it without statutory authority because it costs money. So that's why I had the bill drafted, and I just think if we really want to take a look at how our system is working, if workers are getting served under the workers' comp system or not, then I think we can get to it with that bill.
Well, I think that the lower rates, you have to agree, that's one of the things that business, and you have hundreds in your district as well, but the lower rates have certainly been a benefit to business. And in Oregon, we don't need to do anything to harm business because we're, a lot of businesses are struggling. A lot of businesses are going out of business and a lot of empty storefronts. So as far as the rates are concerned, I think low rates are very beneficial to Oregon, and I think particularly right now. Our own situation is that we are very unlike a lot of businesses where there tends to be high workman's comp claims. But people that are coming to me and have come to me over the years with being claims denied come from all walks of life. Mm-hmm. I mean, they can be the secretary in an office. But there's somehow a lack of sensitivity is what I think, if I could express it, to just kind of put an umbrella over all of it, to the plight of the injured worker. And I don't think that is necessarily individuals at all. I think there's something in the way the process, the checklist that you go through, and that people are only doing their job. That's what they're told to do. And it's not the person being insensitive of the
You're saying it's kind of a culture of insensitivity.
I think it is. And I do not think it is the people involved. I do believe it is the checklist that we go by.
Haven't we run into that, though, whether it's Safe or Liberty or any insurance company in workers' comp or health insurance, there's a culture, I think, quite often a culture of insensitivity there.
Could be. I just would like to see it made more sensitive and a little bit of a different process, and in realizing that when people are injured, there's a lot of trauma that goes to that, and a lot of trauma that goes to the loss of their independence. And so there's a lot of things that go into it, and I just think that we need to look at the process, and I appreciate the work that you've done on that. I'll look at it very close.
Thank you, Senator Verger. Mr. Chair, I would say that I've had many, many people contact me because I've been very vocal on workers' comp issues. And, you know, there was a gentleman who was injured. He assumed it was on the job and it was work-related. A back injury. Safe denied his claim. I believe it was Safe. It could have been another carrier, but I'm pretty certain it was Safe. And he had to go to Kaiser Permanente, which is his wife's insurance. It was a $10,000 surgery, and then Kaiser denied it. And so now it's back between the two fighting about who's going to cover this man's surgery that he had to have. And so this bill, studying that cross-shifting, I think really makes the dollars accountable to the Oregon taxpayer and says, you know, we're doing what's right here. And one of the reasons we have low rates, Senator Verger, the reforms did do some good things. It increased this on-the-job safety programs. We've talked about that, Mr. Chair. Those things help reduce workplace injuries and get people back to work, some of the other back-to-work programs. So the reforms had some good things, but they also had some very bad things, and this is one of the areas that I think we need to look at.
Senator Walker.
Mr. Chair, when I get through, what I'll do also is make some comments maybe more specific to the kinds of things, so it doesn't help people to just be critical.
That's right.
It's very easy to criticize.
but I would like to, rather than do that, just make the suggestions from the coastal perspective of what the process does that I feel is unfair to people who live on the coast and work on the coast and are unfortunate enough to get injured.
Well, I appreciate the discussion we've had this evening. We've touched upon all three of the bills. We haven't finished any of them, but we've touched on them all.
We're making progress, Mr. Chair.
Again, I urge you all to be in contact with the president, and we'll see what our move is from here. Okay? And with that, I'm going to close the work session on Senate Bill 1003 and close the General Government Committee. Thank you. Have a nice weekend.
Thanks.